confused, but death has come into our ghettos to cut off the young men and women from the streets of Philadelphia, New York, L.A., Georgia, Ohio, Florida, Mississippi, and throughout America, South America, the Caribbean islands, Africa, Asia, and all over the world. So return unto me, thus saith Yah, and I will return unto you, O my people.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com. That's the homepage, and listen to the live stream from that location. You can go to blacktalkradionetwork.com. That's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and listen to the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and listen to the live stream at that location also. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the auxiliary connection. That's time for an Awakening Radio program with a live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening Radio Program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, do me a favor and hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening Radio Program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media, the homepage is there also. Undergoing some renovations, but it's there all the same. There you see more interesting content, podcasts, blogs, other programs that you can download, listen at later times, or even share with your friends. Again, some changes being made to timeforawakening.com to incorporate some of the newer programs and their content, and also some upcoming programs that will be debuting in January and in the month of February. So just keep an eye out for those changes, and we'll let you know exactly what's going on in regards to the website. Again, that's timeforawakening.com. Make that one of your favorites, timeforanawakening.com. We'll take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have a special guest join us, author, professor of political science, and the director of African American Studies at the University of San Francisco, Professor James Lance Taylor, is scheduled to be with us. The discussion will center around the claim that the 60s civil rights leaders intentionally made wrong decisions in going after social issues instead of moving to improve the community's economic problems. We'll get into that conversation, hopefully with our guest who's scheduled to be with us, Professor James Lance Taylor, but we'll get things started with the program after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072, spelled new as in numerous, on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum, here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Allen.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. How about yourself?
I'm doing great, man. It's wintertime. It's coat weather. Long John weather for you.
I'm going, I'm getting used to it. So it's I'm putting on my 2-3 year layers. Make sure I'm comfortable.
Man, it ain't even that cold yet, but
I know, but I can't stand it. I'm worried now, like what I'm gonna do when this a cold front truly come in.
Yeah,
stay in. That's what I'm gonna do.
Yeah, well, you won't have to wait much longer. I think it's supposed to drop down into the early 30s and 20s within the next couple of days. So you'll get a little teaser of what's coming.
I hear you.
Tonight, you know, we're looking forward to having Professor Taylor back, Brother Richard. This discussion we're going to touch on tonight is very interesting because, you know, we've heard a lot of things talked about it on this program and sometimes in others in reference to that period, that 60s period during the Civil Rights and Black Power movements and things that was going on in relation with this government. And in relation to our people, COINTELPRO and everything was very active during that period. Before we bring in our guest, author and professor of political science and director of African American Studies at the University of San Francisco, Professor James Lance Taylor, I want to play a clip that'll kind of start this discussion off, a clip by Malcolm in reference to the period we're talking about. And let me see if I can get this queued up here.
Revolution. It was the grassroots out there in the street. Scared the white man to death. Scared the white power structure in Washington, D.C. to death. I was there. When they found out that this black steamroller was going to come down on the Capitol, they called in Wilkins. They called in Randolph. They called in these national Negro leaders that you respect and told them, call it off. Kennedy said, look, y'all letting this thing go too far. And old Tom said, boss, I can't stop it because I didn't start it. I'm telling you what they said. They said, I'm not even in it, much less at the head of it. They said, these Negroes are doing things on their own. They're running ahead of us. And that old shrewd fox He said, well, if you all aren't in it, I'll put you in it. I'll put you at the head of it. I'll endorse it. I'll welcome it. I'll help it. I'll join it. A matter of hours went by. They had a meeting at the Carlisle Hotel in New York City. The Carlisle Hotel is owned by the Kennedy family. That's the hotel Kennedy spent the night at two nights ago. Belongs to his family. A philanthropic society headed by a white man named Stephen Currier called all the top civil rights leaders together at the Carlisle Hotel and told them that by you all fighting each other, you're destroying the civil rights movement. And since you're fighting over money from white liberals, let us set up what's known as the Council for United Civil Rights Leadership. Let's form this council, and all the civil rights organizations will belong to it. And we'll use it for fundraising purposes. Let me show you how tricky the white man is. And as soon as they got it formed, they elected Whitney Young as the chairman. And who you think became the co-chairman? Stephen Currier, the white man. A millionaire. Powell was talking about it down at the Cobo today. This is what he was talking about. Powell knows it happened. Randolph knows it happened. Wilkins knows it happened. King knows it happened. Every one of that so-called Big Six, they know what happened. Once they formed it, with the white man over it, he promised them and gave them $800,000 to split up between the Big Six and told them that after the march was over, they'd give them $700,000 more. $1.5 million split up between leaders that you've been following, going to jail for, crying crocodile tears for, and they've nothing but Frank James and Jesse James and what you call it, brothers. Soon as they got the setup organized, the white man made available to them top public relations experts. Opened the news media across the country at their disposal. And then they began to project these Big Six as the leaders of the march. Originally, they weren't even in the march. You was talking this march talk on Hastings Street. Is Hastings Street still here? On Hastings Street. You was talking the march talk on Lenox Avenue. And down on, Fillmore Street, and Central Avenue, and 42nd Street, and 63rd Street. That's where the march talk was being talked. But the white man put the Big Six ahead of it, made them the march. They became the march. They took it over. And the first move they made after they took it over, they invited Walter Reuther, a white man. They invited a priest. A rabbi and an old white preacher. Yes, an old white preacher. The same white element that put Kennedy in power, labor, the Catholics, the Jews, and liberal Protestants. Same clique that put Kennedy in power joined the
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and I want to welcome in our guest, Professor of Political Science, Director of African American Studies at the University of San Francisco, and author of the book Black Nationalism in the United States, Professor James Lance Taylor. Professor Taylor, how are you, sir?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me back, Elliot, Brother Booker.
It's always great to have you.
Yes.
With myself and Brother Richard.
How you doing there, brother?
I'm doing great, Brother Richard. Happy Christmas Eve to both of you and everyone else.
Same to you, brother. Professor Taylor, I played that segment to kind of start off our discussion, centering around the claim that the 60 civil rights leaders intentionally made the wrong decisions in going after social issues instead of improving the community's economic problems. Start out the discussion around that premise.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, Malcolm, you know, that's one of my favorite speeches of all of Malcolm's, and that's the message to the grassroots. And he outlines clearly his evolving sort of understanding of nationalism and trying to sort of speak to it, and, you know, sort of trying to define at that point, because he was on the verge of leaving the Nation of Islam at that point, he's sort of outlining his, you know, understanding of what Black nationalism is, its value in the United States, its potential revolutionary, possibilities, and how that sort of, you know, connected to the larger demand for justice, and for Blacks, you know, sort of claims against the United States. And one of the, I think, things that people don't really get a good understanding of is the way in which the mainstream civil rights movement that is largely initiated by the NAACP and its formation, in 1909, is that it largely imposes a kind of integrationist framework into the mainstream of Black social thought, and largely emerges to challenge the rise of Booker Washington, who from 1895 to 1915 was the dominant political and, I guess, cultural figure in Black life in America. And the NAACP didn't like the implications of that part of Booker Washington's agenda that was about Black self-development and Black separate development in terms of his well-known 1895 Atlanta Exposition speech. In Atlanta, he gives this famous speech. It's kind of his I Have a Dream speech, Booker Washington's, and he takes his five fingers and he says that Blacks and whites should be as united as the separate as the five fingers when it comes to sort of voluntary associations, marriage, private matters, but they should be as united as the fifth when it comes to economic development, capitalism here in America, opportunity. Booker Washington was saying that, you know, that Blacks and whites could have common ground economically, even if they couldn't coexist culturally, and he didn't want that kind of coexistence. But the NAACP rose to challenge that, because the NAACP, with its largely Christian liberal integrationist orientation, found it repugnant to its sensitivities and I guess values that Booker Washington would embrace the idea that we could have separate development in America, as he was actually advocating. And many of the radicals of the 60s didn't appreciate this about Booker Washington. They, Booker Washington and Uncle Tom, for many reasons. But this part of Booker Washington, Manning Marable, wrote and documented, definitely included an element of Black nationalism. In fact, Manning Marable understood Booker Washington through the lens and framework of Black nationalism. And there's a published article by Manning Marable about Booker Washington's Black nationalism, inherent in his accommodationist ideology, that basically says, you know, that we should be united with whites in economic interaction and intercourse, but we should stay completely apart from each other in terms of private life, voluntary association, you know, just keep it separate. And the NAACP found this unacceptable. And so Mary White Ovington Garrison Oswald Villison was the grandson of William Lloyd Garrison, and he actually begins the process of formulating the NAACP, and so the NAACP largely grows directly out of abolitionism, and it challenges Booker Washington, and then it turns to challenge Marcus Garvey, who came later to the United States to meet Booker Washington. And unfortunately, Garvey didn't get to meet Booker because Booker died in 1915 before they could meet, and Garvey arrives about 1916, and they never do get to connect. But Garvey comes to America, and he's admiring one man only, and that's Booker Washington. And when he goes to New York and meets W.E.B. Du Bois and a bunch of light-skinned blacks working in New York City, Garvey experiences a kind of cultural shock to see this kind of light-skinned bourgeoisie as he saw it, and said that when he went to the NAACP headquarters in New York looking for black leaders, you know, he couldn't find any. And he, you know, creates the United Negro Improvement Association. But it's important for us to understand, as modern, you know, so-called, you know, contemporary African-American, you know, people, that what we sort of have been given, you know, as naturalized integration was actually the result of a contested ideological struggle between those nationalist elements in the United Negro Improvement Association and the integrationist elements in the black church and the NAACP combined. And we've always had this sort of, you know, two-ness, or this sort of double consciousness, or this sort of binary ideological orientation toward this country. And this is really at the heart of the work of Harold Cruse in The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, where he's trying to get at how we have these two warring tendencies, these habits of nationalism and integrationism. And Malcolm and Martin Luther King represent that in the post-World War II period. And so the reality is that the NAACP won out that struggle. And Martin Luther King comes along really, you know, after Brown versus Board of Education and inspired by it, and finishes the job. You know, by the 1965 Voting Rights Act being signed, that 11 years between Brown versus Board of Education 54 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, King pretty much was like Mariano Rivera, if you will, in baseball, the closer. You know, King just came and closed the deal that the earlier stage of the liberal integrationist orientation initiated in its attempt to compete against the kind of early leadership that black America was supporting in the person of Booker Washington and later Garvey up in New Harlem. And so the NAACP, you know, found a way through using Du Bois's ability to write through the crisis as a propaganda outlet to agitate for black rights and equality rights. But they emphasized the 14th Amendment and the equal protection implicit in it, and the equality implicit in the amendment. And out of the Civil War came three amendments, the 13th that abolishes slavery, the 14th that provides equal protection, immunities and privileges, and due process, and then the 15th Amendment, which gave African-American males, not black women, the right to vote, at least on paper, in 1870. And of course, it takes, you know, 95 more years in 1965 for that to be protected. But at least these are the three Civil War amendments. Now, out of
Professor Taylor? Mm-hmm. Uh-oh. Professor Taylor? I think we must have lost him briefly.
I'm here.
Oh, okay. I got you. Something must happen. Go ahead.
I think I may have hit my phone.
Okay.
But I think at a critical point, choices were made and decisions were made not only by the movement lawyers and litigants and activists, but earlier in constitutional adjudication. The Supreme Court itself signaled early how it was going to interpret those amendments. So the 13th Amendment, which would be the basis of African-American claims against this country and the American state and the society itself in terms of, say, a reparations claim, had been narrowly defined and narrowly interpreted increasingly by the courts from the very beginning with a case known as the Slaughterhouse Cases in 1873, these cases become the first hearing of the court on the on any of the three amendments. And the court interprets the 14th Amendment in such a narrow way that it's a case where a bunch of white butchers were suing the state of Louisiana for forcing them to do their, you know, butchery or whatever the work is that they do, properly called, in one location at one butcher house, at one slaughterhouse, and they felt that this was a monopoly, so they sued and said they were being forced into involuntary servitude as a consequence of having to use this one slaughterhouse. And the Supreme Court agreed in general that the 13th Amendment could be applied beyond issues of slavery. Like, this is a case where these white men were saying they were being forced into involuntary servitude. So the general reading, the court didn't have a beef with that. But it didn't, you know, form the basis of an approach to sort of applying the 13th Amendment to the modern civil rights struggle that emerges somewhere around the 1940s in a series of cases and as a consequence of the work of Charles Houston, of course, of Howard University, and, you know, who becomes the inspiration for Thurgood Marshall and others, Constance Bakeley, Baker and others, who, you know, are all these young NAACP lawyers, many of them trained at Howard University School of Law, who become the, you know, the sort of Young Turk advance guard, who challenges the equal protection and the discrimination implicit in, say, the 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson case that, you know, gives us the doctrine of separate but equal. These young lawyers challenge the separateness and the inequality, excuse me, implicit in the separateness, and that becomes the basis of undoing Jim Crow segregation in Brown v. 1, 1954, and then there was a second Brown versus Board of Education, 1955. So there's a long history of both the court's way of interpreting the 13th Amendment narrowly to limit its elasticity over into discrimination broadly affecting blacks in America, and there's also the modern when the modern civil rights movement legal agenda emerges in the 1940s, they actually choose not to focus on the 13th Amendment, but to employ the 14th Amendment as a means to challenging discrimination and inequality, and that becomes, you know, sort of what the rub is about whether or not the 13th Amendment itself would have been a better basis on which to approach these cases, because there are ways in which African Americans can be the subjects of 13 that other groups can't fit in terms of actual injury to them as a people. Whereas with the 14th Amendment, every group is entitled to equal protection, even if we are the ones that brought it through.
Professor Taylor, and corporations.
What do you say, Richard?
And corporations.
Oh, okay.
Under the 14th Amendment extended protection.
That's right. That's right. And that's the real irony of it, is that we went from being three-fifths of human, three-fifths of a person, And we're trying to get recovery from that injury and through the 13th, 14th, and 15th. And when we get that at least legal, you know, recognition, the court interprets it not to give us humanity and agency, but to give corporations humanity and agency. And that's the real the irony of American history to me, is the 14th Amendment. When I teach it in my classes and talk to my students about this, we look at a whole body of case law that shows, along with the slaughterhouse cases, how the court basically took the way in which blacks were dehumanized and took the remedy for that and gave human agency to corporations. And so now in America, corporations have agency as humans, as we all know, and very few people know that that came at the expense of black black humanity and our predicament in America.
Professor Taylor, I want to go back to what you mentioned in the beginning to kind of push it up to that 60s period, because there's a strange dichotomy there when you're talking about Booker Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. And you also see a human development similar to Martin and Malcolm, because later on, history shows us that W.E.B. Du Bois got disillusioned and quit the NAACP.
That's right.
So looking back, because Booker Washington, Booker T. Washington was out there doing things when W.E.B. Du Bois really started to gain prominence. Looking back at that situation, and we know the dollars that started the NAACP and the figures involved were a lot of white Jewish people at that time. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they were courting him the whole time for a purpose that they wanted? Because it became obvious to him that he didn't like the direction that the organization was going in when he was arguably one of the leaders of the organization.
Well, absolutely. I think this is clear in the founding of the organization. Du Bois is there, but he and Oswald Villard Garrison, again, that's the grandson of William Lloyd Garrison, and others, continued, to have differences. When he wrote his, sort of 1935 sort of temporary segregation treaties, where he felt like there might be necessary to have temporary segregation, just like Martin Luther King did his final days.
That's what I was going to say.
Similar argument.
Okay.
Martin Luther King made a similar argument. It cost Booker Washington his connection. It caused W.E.B. Du Bois' relationship with the NAACP, but it was already on the fringes because of his, very difficult relationship with Walter White, who was the executive secretary of the NAACP.
And it just kind of ties in with what you were stating earlier about the amendments to the Constitution. It seems as though, and I played a little segment with John Henry Clark in the beginning about history being a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It seems as though if we have a critical look and discussion on these matters, that Europeans are always looking to one-up African Americans. And when I say one-up, I'm talking about they make plans, even if it looked like they're making concessions. It's already a plan A and a plan B in the back room or in storage if something goes awry with the first plan. It doesn't seem like our people had been making plans in dealing with Europeans, because they look at Europeans from a different lens than Europeans look at us. It's clear from the earlier interactions, especially with the formation of the NAACP in reference to Booker T. Washington.
No, I think you're right. I think, like you said, I think the way in which the NAACP originally wanted to work with Booker, and then it decided to challenge him and his organization, and then when he dies, it decides to go after Garvey. And Booker and Du Bois, took a personal disdain for Garvey, and Garvey took a personal disdain for Du Bois, and you had these two tremendous black geniuses. The most successful black mass movement leader in the modern era that we know of was Marcus Garvey, and one of the most brilliant black thinkers anywhere, or any kind of thinker anywhere ever, was W.E.B. Du Bois. And on the scene, both men together focused more on something like their appearance than the substance of their ideas in terms of Pan-Africanism. In terms of nationalism, in terms of integration, these two men spent more time name-calling than they did trying to map out a theory of America for black America. in the way that people were trying to come up with Pan-Africanism. You know, most black thinkers have never thought through a theory of being black in America. We, you know, black power may have been a gesture towards something, but no one thought it through outside of, I think, outside of Harold Cruse, very deeply. And so, you know, we end up sort of, you know, trying to get a hold on our own, you know, political history and understanding who and where we are at a given time. And we allow other people in turn to, you know, to sort of, define and determine our history for us. And so, yeah, when Booker emerges, Booker is not, Du Bois is not offered up as the sort of counter to the reality of Booker Washington and Du Bois is split. And it's more, it was actually a split. And Cruse sees them as more ideologically in agreement around education's importance and having real differences over methodology than over anything. The real division between Booker Washington and Du Bois came when the first black Phi Beta Kappa from Harvard University was William Monroe Trotter.
Trotter, right. Mm-hmm.
And Trotter was a good friend of Du Bois when they were younger, and he helped create the Niagara Movement out of which the NAACP came, and he was so radical he wouldn't even want to be in an organization with the white liberal elements that you mentioned earlier, so he never joined in to the NAACP, William Monroe Trotter. He kind of remains on his own up in Boston writing The Guardian and using it, and he begins to attack. And he's attacking Booker Washington. And then Booker Washington goes up to Faneuil Hall in Boston and tries to expand his leadership to become this national black leader. And this happened to Martin Luther King, too, when he went up to Harlem and when he went to Chicago. When Booker Washington went to Boston, a riot broke out and William Monroe Trotter got arrested. And Booker Washington pressed charges on William Monroe Trotter, the first black Phi Beta Kappa from Harvard University. Booker Washington pressed charges on him, and he was prosecuted. And Du Bois was upset with that action. And that's the real reason that Du Bois splits with Booker Washington, no other. And most people don't even acknowledge that. But that's so in 1903, when The Souls of Black Folk is written, it's this riot in Boston where Trotter attacks Washington that leads to the most famous chapter of the book, The Souls of Black Folk, of Mr. Booker T. Washington and others. That's singly the most important chapter in that important book with a whole bunch of important chapters, because it was a political sort of declaration of independence by Du Bois, because he was separating because of that incident, but not because of ideological difference. But the NAACP's white leadership certainly thought that the best way for blacks to be accepted and to exist in America would be through integration, through assimilation, through through these sort of, you know, mainstreaming of blacks into the society, as opposed to a kind of, you know, development of blacks separately in the larger society to reflect the reality of their separate existence in America.
That'll bring us to kind of where we are at this subject tonight. Now, right. let me throw this in, and I want Brother Richard to start to chime in. And I want to get your perspective, both you men's perspective. The 63 March on Washington. Now, the segment I played, Malcolm was reflecting on the men involved. This is my spin on it, and I want you men to kind of weigh in on it, because I'm looking at this historically. King, because I want to put him to the side for a time, because King, in my perspective, was a young man on the scene. All these other men were older men. They needed a young voice, a But Martin Luther King had been thrust on the scene from that Montgomery boycott in the late 50s. So he was kind of gaining prominence. So I believe that they were kind of courting him when he became involved with them. One of the men that was instrumental in that 60s movement, civil rights movement, and they brought out some information here recently I read, was Baird Rustin.
Yeah.
It said that Baird Rustin, in this recently released documents, and some of them was redacted. Now, I don't know why they still have them redacted, but they did. Recently released documents showed that Baird Rustin was working for the CIA. And the writer of the article made a joke about it, saying, well, Baird Rustin was under surveillance by the FBI, but evidently the FBI didn't know that he was working for the CIA.
Wow.
And then they showed documents from the late 50s where, you know, he was on the street as a male prostitute. And I guess they might have been using this over him. I don't know. But it was clear that he was working with them. They released these documents showing a man that was so-called instrumental in the civil rights movement worked for the CIA. So let's spin this conversation on to some of the other leaders, Wilkins and some of the others, in relation to the premise of the discussion, Professor Taylor.
Sure. No, I mean, that's a fact. Bayard Rustin was arrested at least three times. In fact, up in Maryland and Virginia, he tested early the bus discrimination laws with white comrades. They would go and integrate the buses and test, you know, they pushed, you're trying to push the limits. They didn't go in the Deep South, but they were up in Virginia and Maryland area. And Rustin got arrested. And this, you know, led to him going to jail. When he went to jail, he was accused of, inappropriate sexual conduct for a third time. And on one occasion, he was giving speeches in Pasadena to raise money. This is on Brother Outsider, and this is on Brother on Both Sides of the Cross, I think is the second book of Bayard Rustin. But he was trying to raise funds to go to India to see Gandhi, who he would later teach Martin Luther King's ideas to. And in the process, after he gave his speech, he went out into the car in the hotel lobby or the hotel parking lot, and he and two white men, some believe they were undercover cops, and he were caught in a sexually compromising situation, and he was arrested. And this was three different times, and Martin Luther King didn't want to be bothered. In fact, Martin Luther King didn't want to be associated with Bayard Rustin with the March on Washington. Now, Bayard Rustin is the one who gets 250,000 people out there, and Asa Philip Randolph is the one who oversaw it because King didn't want Rustin. And it was only because Asa Philip Randolph put his power behind Rustin and told King and others, Bayard is going to do this or you're going to lose me. And that would, you know, the whole thing would fall apart because he was the important labor component. Bayard Rustin, organized the March on Washington. This was something that had happened to him. This issue even haunted Martin Luther King. You talk about these, you know, tapes and redacted tapes. The recently revealed tapes in the last year, not tapes, but in the last year, a woman scholar found the original letter from the FBI that urged Martin Luther King to kill himself before it exposed him as a sexual deviant. And the letter implied that King was sexually interested in women and men. And even Jackie Onassis made this claim in now revealed tapes that we now have that no one knew existed for 50 years, where she's saying that terrible things about Martin Luther King. People can Google this, where she said, Martin Luther King was a terrible man, and he was laughing at at her husband's funeral, and Martin Luther King had tried to have an orgy at the March on Washington. This is all Googleable information. This is not stuff I'm making up at all. This all happened in the last 3 to 5 years. new information. And so in the last year and a half, the actual original unredacted suicide letter from the FBI to Martin Luther King was found, and its content was fully read. And now we know that the FBI was implying that King had some interest in men. Now, the interesting thing with that is that Congressman Adam Clayton Powell Jr., the powerful black congressman from Harlem, threatened Martin Luther King with slandering him with a relationship with Bayard Rustin if he and Asa Philip Randolph had actually marched against the Democrats in Atlantic City as King and Asa Philip Randolph were talking about doing as a part of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party fallout. And when, you know, so Powell was playing hardball with King, the thing he used was this threat of Bayard Rustin's sexuality. So King was very reticent about being associated with Bayard Rustin. He knew Bayard Rustin was a brilliant man. He knew Bayard Rustin was a brilliant thinker and strategist. And it is he who taught King what King believed later about Gandhi and studied about Gandhi, because King had only heard of it through his father and other ministers in the church who were aware of Gandhi's teachings, but he didn't really have a full understanding of it. When Bayard Rustin first went to King's house in 1955 during the Montgomery boycott, Bayard Rustin went there and found King with armed guards in front of his house and guns at the house. And because King was a Southerner just like other black Southerners, and they believed in, you know, self-defense and used the guns for all kind of purposes, for hunting as well. And so this bothered Rustin, and he told King, basically, you have to become nonviolence. You have to become the embodiment of it. And this is where King becomes a strong disciple of the concept of you know, ahimsa and satyagraha, these Hindu concepts around nonviolence and do no harm.
Richard,
it seems to me what I'm grappling with, Professor Taylor, is the notion, and you raise, you know, Cruz a couple of times, and I think the only thing I kind of grapple and hold on to as we talk about this period is Cruz making a statement about this non-economic liberalism, right? And the yes. question of the question of whether the NAACP, primarily, as you said, ran by the abolitionist wing, I'm gonna call it that, because that yes. gives us this historical context. Seeing Africans wanting to be a part of the American body, but not necessarily fully Americans, because if I understand the abolition still didn't recognize Africans okay. had the same level of outcome ability as Europeans as a movement.
And
from that, but this non-economic liberalism that the civil rights era pushes the social end compared to the economic development end. And this goes push back to where Elliot, where you started from, because I remember that meeting that you read to us about those African leaders after the Civil War felt, as you say, Professor Taylor, Booker was saying that we perceive ourselves, let us just be separate and we will develop our own instead of trying to totally try to get incorporated with whites, we'll recognize, we'll self-separate and develop our own agency. And that's a term I would use, or that's what I extract from the transcript. We will develop our own agency through economics, our social education, and our social relationship. And maybe later we'll, once whites are willing to change their perception about us, we can be able to get into this broader project. But that economic development seemed to have been going on all the way up to the 60s, where you had cooperatives still operating. The Federation of Southern Cooperatives. So mm-hmm. black people had an economic
project and program. But the leadership of the civil rights and the men who, as y'all laid out, who were paid to kind of navigate it, wanted to move away from the economic development aspect of Black agency to just the social development. Am I wrong in that characterization of that?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. And I think this is, you know, one of the great oversights of the civil rights movement in terms of an actual economic agenda. And I think as much as the March on Washington was also for jobs, peace and freedom was the motto. It was more about moral suasion, about the moral right thing to do. I mean, you did have labor commitments and you had labor activism. You know, you had, again, Asa Philip Randolph with the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters at the helm of all of this activity. He was the dean of this whole moment. But clearly, the fear of being associated with communism is, you know, the overarching elephant in the room for the Black leadership class, especially King, because he has as his, you know, main advisor, Jewish, you know, ex-communist Stanley Levinson as his advisor, you know, who helped write the Beyond Vietnam speech and the speech, you know, at Riverside Church that basically talks about civil rights and labor and how these two things can come together to the advantage of everybody. And so there was always this fear of the Black movement because of J. Edgar Hoover's obsession with the communist infiltration of the Black movement during the Cold War. Any sort of economic argument around anti-capitalism or to be critical of capitalism publicly reeked of communism. And now we know in the posthumous writings of Martin Luther King, there's a small book by the late Vincent Harding called The Inconvenient Martin Luther King. He documents statements that I had never read anywhere else. And this is a major disciple of King's, of Vincent Harding. He wrote the great book, There is a River. One of the greatest books I've ever read in my life was There is a River. You read that book, Brother Booker?
Yeah, that's
a beautiful book.
Richard.
And this brother, he writes a small piece on King, and he describes Martin Luther King as a troubling, you know, inconvenient hero, and documents actual statements of private meetings with King where King said, capitalism, there's something wrong with our economic system. There's something wrong with capitalism. And he said, we need social democracy. Martin Luther King. I cite that in my most recent publication in a book as a part of a chapter of a book that came out recently on the post civil rights relevance of Martin Luther King. I looked at hip hop and tried and sort of grounded King in that history because I think we sometimes, like hip hop, I argued in the piece, you know, as this sort of one-dimensional Martin Luther King, that they only understood Martin Luther King in the conventional sense of the dream. And so the hip-hop movement made a choice in the 80s to raise Malcolm up. And we all were wearing Malcolm X hats, and we were talking self-destruction, and we were talking all the positive, you know, Black consciousness in the hip-hop music with Chuck D and KRS-One, et cetera. And we failed to recognize that at that very critical moment. Even as Martin Luther King had become radicalized from 65 until he dies in 68 and is under nobody's control, the hip-hop movement only understood Martin Luther King in the context of I Have a Dream, because that's the only way they ever cite and refer to Martin Luther King, as if he didn't go off the, you know, off the path from 65 to 68, criticizing Vietnam, standing with Muhammad Ali when nobody else was, before Jim Brown, before Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, before Ernie Davis and all those other athletes who stood with Ali. Martin Luther King stood with Ali and supported him openly, even as a Black Muslim who was being considered a separatist and a racist along with the Nation of Islam. Martin Luther King went to Africa before Malcolm and before Eldridge Cleaver, and before Stokely Carmichael, and before any of the so-called black militant radicals that went to, you know, looking at African independent revolutionary movements, Martin Luther King went to Ghana in 1956. And when he saw Ghana's independence in 1956, he went there with Asa Philip Randolph and a few other well-known black leaders like Ralph Bunche, who was a well-known, respected, ambassador, and others. He and his wife went. Martin Luther King said that when he went to Ghana and saw the independence of Ghana and these black people, and he got sick. He and his wife got sick and had to come home within a day. This is what happened to King. He and his wife went there. They were overwhelmed by the image of the independence of this self-black running country. And King said that inspired him to come back to America, and he knew what he needed to do next for black America. For some reason, what he saw in Ghana inspired him that it could help us here in America. So Ghana and Kwame Nkrumah inspires Martin Luther King in ways that most black militant and left radicals of the 60s never got to know, because King's writings were only discovered after he was dead, where he's condemning capitalism and he's talking about, ways in which he was inspired by African independent revolution.
And does that speak to how the civil rights era language, or and even now, it doesn't have a critique in relationship to how Africans fit within the capitalist framework? Because Manny Marble kind of speaks to that in that underdevelopment of black capitalism. Africa's underdevelopment of capitalism, I think African-Americans underdevelopment in capitalism. So it's a structural issue besides a social rights issue in relationship to Africans' participation within the American or within the capitalist construct. And it seems that what you're presenting is that King starts to make his own analysis that this is to be true. Even if you have rights, if you don't have your own economic infrastructure, then rights mean nothing. And that was a discussion earlier with either Booker T or with Garvey in Universal Negro. It's about agency from an economic relationship.
And the beauty about what you're saying right now, I mean, you are hitting it like right down the line, and also bringing this conversation into the current debate going on now with Cornel West and Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yes.
Because Cornel West is trying to, suggest just that Ta-Nehisi Coates is offering a pessimism and a sort of disappointment in the reality of black experience in America, apart from a social and structural critique. Cornel West does, wants to attach to Ta-Nehisi Coates a requirement that he speak against capitalism and that he, attach white supremacy as the overarching structure for all of it. And he feels that Ta-Nehisi Coates does not sufficiently do that. And then he feels like Ta-Nehisi Coates has, embraced Obama in some way that puts Obama in a genealogical path with Malcolm X. And that is what he finds, most upsetting. And this is something I try to do in my own book, is to try to outline the ways in which the hip hop generation itself is more of what I'm interested in terms of when I'm talking about in the subtitle of my book, From Malcolm X to Barack Obama. That really bookends the hip hop generation's experience in black nationalism, which is what my book is all about, is trying to get at what was black nationalism to people born in the 60s, who weren't militants in the 60s, but those of us who were the babies, what Mark Anthony Neal called soul babies in his book with that title, and how do we properly, critique capitalism and also, find ways to talk about black agency, as you say.
And that's a difficult challenge. Yeah,
I mean, it is. But I think we underestimate if how much of the mess we're in has to do with the ways in which we just haven't thought through our history. And this is what a piece I'm writing right now, as I'm writing this, as I continue to write this book on People's Temple, Jim Jones and Black America, the part I'm in right now is looking at Cruz and how he understood what I would recommend to you both to read, a fascinating piece. I mean, I've read The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual and Plural But Equal, but a colleague of mine shared with me a piece called Black and White. The subtitle is something like the next stage. And Cruz is trying to get at the ways in which Black movements sort of imploded on the same misunderstanding of the current realities of Black people as had happened in the past. So Booker Washington thinks he can go up to Boston in 1903 and represent a leadership and become its leadership to nationalize himself as a Black leader, because he had already been widely respected, but he was trying to expand his base, just like King going up into Chicago. Michael Eric Dyson's book, I May Not Get There With You, you know, says that King's career was basically split between BC and AD, before Chicago and after defeat by Daley in 1966. Where King tries to nationalize his leadership. There's another book called When Harlem Nearly Killed King that also hits at this dimension of King trying to expand his leadership up into Harlem. It's like, no, Martin Luther King, you are a leader in Atlanta, Georgia. Your dream should be for Atlanta, Georgia. Huey Newton, you are a leader in Oakland. Your Black Power, Black Panther movement should be to develop Black Oakland. But when these different strata of Black cadres or Black leaders try to reach beyond their lanes, as the kids would say today, and begin to assert and project themselves as a leader of the national Black Panther Party or the leader of a national, you know, Black civil rights movement, is when you get into conflict with local existing structures of leadership. And this is something that King, I think, you know, experiences happen with Booker Washington, and it happens again in Black Power, where you had the West Coast Panthers, who emerged out of the late 1940s urban migration relative to Blacks who had been in Philadelphia and New York and Boston since the 1700s, and then Blacks in Detroit and in Chicago since the turn of World War I. Oakland and West Coast out here, I'm in Oakland right now. Out here in the West Coast, Blacks didn't really come out here until the 1940s in terms of massive migration, as much as whites did too. And Cruz argues that there's a very different Black politics that emerges out of these very different Black migrations. And the problem was that in the West Coast, the West Coast movements that emerge in the 1940s, which are basically new on the scene, begin to project themselves in Chicago and in Detroit and in Harlem, where leaderships have been in place for decades and decades and even centuries in some cases, and how this often led to an implosion of our movement. And you see this very same phenomena, I think, happened with King and Malcolm X. You know, Malcolm and King are trying to, you know, carve out which way is it going to be. And Cruz says, we need all styles. We need all approaches in our struggle to deal with the reality we have in America. And what we have to first undertake is an assessment of what is happening amongst our people. And this is why I consider myself a student of Harold Cruz, because he at least requires students of Black people to pay attention to Black people, mm-hmm. and to look at what's happening. So in World War I, World War II, he says so much of the conflict that happens, so much of the conflict that happens in the black movement is because of people overstepping their territory and their boundaries. So you had Panthers in Harlem and Panthers in Chicago shooting each other. I'm sorry, Panthers in Harlem and the Panthers from Detroit and Newark, you know, shooting at each other, drive-bys on fellow black nationalists because you disagree ideologically. And what Cruz was suggesting is that there's a need for Harlem to develop what its gift was, which was the cultural tradition of our history. Philadelphia had its own revolutionary history going back to the foundations of the AME Church, to the creation of the black, the Masons, to the whole, you know, sort of revolutionary tradition of independent thinking in terms of, I'm trying to think of the founder of the black Masons, Prince Paul. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Prince Paul, mm-hmm. You know, that those early, black communities in Philadelphia. And so when you start talking about the 60s, the Panthers or the nation in Philadelphia, the Panthers or the nation in Harlem, what Cruz says is that all of these young people with all of this amazing energy got misdirected. And that's the language he uses. They got misdirected because they didn't understand their own history. They didn't understand the previous stage of black reconstruction, he says, was our political phase. It was the first phase. We didn't understand that. And then we moved to an economic phase under Booker Washington. He says we didn't understand that. And then we moved to a cultural phase in Harlem, in the Harlem Renaissance, and we didn't understand that. So when we come up in the post, because Great Depression and World War II were such significant events, they literally erased and created a generation gap in the understanding of how those three previous stages of political, cultural, and economic development in that order happened, and how we could have used those three phases of our own history to continue interpreting our role and place in America rather than reaching for Pan-Africanism or racial separation or going back to Africa-type political organizing. We could have developed a black politics in America based on the fact that we actually developed three stages of history that we don't even acknowledge, brothers. I just gave all three to you from the Reconstruction period, the Booker Washington period. The Reconstruction period, he says, is the political period. The Booker Washington period, 1895, 1915, is our economic period, where you had 60,000 independent black businesses throughout America with the national, his organization was the National Labor Relations Board. The National Business League.
Which Du Bois gave him the concept.
Right. And so the cultural phase was the Harlem Renaissance. And Cruz said that when we let Harlem go, we didn't understand that we were letting everything go because it was the cultural front is where black America is the most powerful. And that's where we should have used our advantages to attack America in terms of a cultural revolution. That's where we could have had the most success. We couldn't have it politically and we couldn't have it militarily, but we could definitely have great success in America culturally, not only in terms of our ongoing creativity, but if we could learn to control the economic component of our art and of black music, the way, and I'm not anti-Semitic, but the way in which we all know the, you know, Hollywood Jewish connection is, if we understood our culture like they have and were able to benefit from our culture, going back to Cadillac Records and the exploitation of generations of previous black artists, going back to the 30s and 40s, Cruz says if we could get control over our own music and our own art, then we can begin to fund our own existence in America. We could fund our own communities and our schools through our art and our culture, but we've never been able to get control of it. And that is where Ray Charles and others, you know, who were able to get some modicum of independence and control are, you know, are important examples.
You know, we're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, we'll continue the conversation with author, professor of political science, and director of African-American studies at University of San Francisco, Professor James Lance Taylor is with us. We're talking about the period of the 60s and civil rights leaders intentionally making the wrong decisions and going after social issues instead of improving the community's economic problems. We're also going to spin off into other subjects, the political environment now in relation to this topic. And something that you just mentioned, Professor Taylor, I want to talk about it because I want to reintroduce another clip right after the break in reference to what you alluded to a few minutes ago about our different movements and the things that we could have done. But I think it's something that I'm going to add to the discussion that is very important, I think, and it is raising its head more and more. It never stopped bowing its head. It's always there. Malcolm alluded to it in the speech we played in the beginning, and I'm going to allude to it in this clip I play right after the break, but it's something I want to introduce to the conversation. And you can join the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Get involved in the conversation. Time for Awakening. We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
Nah, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either.
Mm-mm. Nah, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you would on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm gonna go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our stories.
Let's buy Black365.com.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
Today our people can see that we're faced with a government conspiracy. This government has failed us. The senators who are filibustering concerning your and my rights, that's the government. Don't say it, Southern senators, this is the government. This is a government filibuster. It's not a segregationist filibuster. It's a government filibuster. Any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. So this government has failed us. The government itself has failed us. And the white liberals who have been posing as our friends have failed us. And once we see that all these other sources to which we've turned have failed, we stop turning to them and turn to ourselves. We need a self-help program, a do-it-yourself philosophy, a do-it-right-now philosophy, it's already too late philosophy. This is what you and I need to get with. And the only way we're going to solve our problem is with a self-help program. Before we can get a self-help program started, we have to have a self-help philosophy. Black nationalism is a self-help philosophy. What's so good about it? You can stay right in the church where you are and still take black nationalism as your philosophy.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we go back to our special guest this evening, I want to play a clip that kind of fits into what we're doing in the direction I want to move into. Right after this clip, I'll throw out the premise of why I brought it up. You'll hear in the beginning Eldridge Cleaver briefly in the first portion of this clip, and then it transitions into to the subject matter of the clip. But let me play this before we go back and bring back in our special guest this evening, author and professor of political science and director of African American Studies at the University of San Francisco, Professor James Lance Taylor. Here we go.
In the meantime, those white agents, try as they might, were not able to infiltrate our ranks because the Black Panther Party did not have any white members, okay? And we relied upon people that we knew. And we kept people that we didn't know on another level. And I think this is why we didn't suffer more, put it that way, because they did catch up and start a crash program of recruiting black agents, and they very quickly filled that gap, but it took them about a year to do it.
In the summer of 1978, I interviewed a man who worked as an informer for the FBI during the 1960s. His name is Dothard Perry, also known as Ed Riggs, also known as Bill Perry, also known as Othello.
How were you paid?
The pay was always in cash. Cash, and you would sign a card. It would go like this. A rendezvous or a drop-off point would be picked out either by yourself or the agent. You would meet the agent there, and usually it would be in a vehicle. You get in the vehicle, he would hand you the money. He would tell you first to count the money. He would tell you the amount while you counted it. If the amount was there, he would then bring out a card. On that card would be for the week of such and such. In other words, the week was dated. So-and-so has been paid the amount of. Then you would sign the card, and then the agent would sign the card. The reason for this is that if all of a sudden the IRS became very interested about where you were getting all this extra money from, you could always tell them to go back to the Bureau, and the Bureau would have your cards on file.
I see. Were there such things as bonuses?
Oh, yes.
What were they paid for?
Bonuses were paid for, suppose while you were meeting with, or you were at a meeting with Bobby Seale's, Chulai of the Red Army happened to come to the meeting too, which is something which would be a new development. That's bonus time.
In other words, a hot piece of information.
Hot piece, very hot piece.
Did you ever suffer pangs of conscience?
Quite a few times. Quite a few times. I still suffer pangs of conscience. I suffer from the fact that a lot of people trusted me, and I misused that trust. I suffer from the fact that a lot of information that I gave out was the undoing of certain groups or certain people. I suffer from the fact that I'm on the run constantly. I have no real life to speak of.
You have no family life, really? You have a wife?
No, I don't have a wife. I do have a child. I can't see her that often. I have to stay away from them because once I come around, the Bureau shows up and harassment starts. I have very few close personal friends, no one to really confide in. It's like being on the outside of a glass jar and everything is happening inside the jar, but you're on the outside. You can see it happening, but you can't participate.
Why have you decided to talk to me?
For the simple reason, I think this information should be put out to the public. I think not only black people, but everyone should become aware of what your so-called law enforcement agencies do to so-called enforce the law. Because between you, myself, and the audience, I've seen more felons in law enforcement than I have in prison.
Many would say, well, look, you yourself just got through saying that the DLA was involved in criminal activity. What's wrong with wanting to put them in prison? How would you answer them?
I would answer them this way. First off, we have to understand why they did what they did. But I'm not even going to go off into that psychological hoo-ha. What I'm going to say is when you become just as bad as the people that you go after, then there's nothing gained and a whole lot lost.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And that was a clip about an informant. He had several names, one under the name of Duther Perry, that talked about his involvement during the 60s and what he admitted was his demise of organizations and individuals. Before I kind of mention some of the things that I want to talk about in reference to that clip, Professor Taylor and Richard, let me, because we got a couple calls waiting, let me pull them into the conversation. Let's go to 602, area code 602.
Yes, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard and Dr. Taylor. This is Marcus.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Dr. Taylor giving out a lot of information tonight, you know, a lot of information I wasn't aware of. Dr. Du Bois, you know, I read that book, The Soul of Black Folk, and that was a very good book. You know, he spoke about the dual personality in the black man. That's that dual, you know, personality in the black man. And I think we still, you know, have that conflict today, mm-hmm. you know, amongst our people, you know, trying to decide, which direction to go in, you know, trying to live amicably with this European man, you know, and you know it's a conflict. But you know, one thing I noticed was with Martin Luther King and with Du Bois, it was the same white liberal that was there in the flying the white men.
Mm-hmm.
You notice, you know, they were there in Du Bois movement, you know, in the NAACP, and they were there in Mr. King's movement.
Right.
See, that white liberal element, you know, posing as our friend, you know, so we got to watch these people, you know, they are not our friends, you know, they're not our friends. So,
I think we can accept that if we just like in, you know, black folk voting down in Alabama, you know, for this guy Doug Jones against Roy Moore. If you're gonna play the game, get something out of it, you know, politically. At least be aware of the circumstance so that you, you know, you at least have no permanent friends, no permanent enemies,
just permanent interests.
Exactly. And we've gotten caught up in being permanent Democrats instead of, you know, trying to figure out a more independent way to be black in America with the same raw material of blackness. And that's what I mean when I say we don't look at the raw material of the, for example, what I mean is black folk are growing. We're not being genocided. We're not being wiped out. Our population is actually exploding. We're actually growing to be 75 million people by the year 2050. Now, you do the math. That's less than 50 years from now. And they're saying that the black American population will be 65 million people in about 25 years, and there'll be 75 million in 35 years. The rest of the country as a whole will grow. The white population will cap off at 199 million in 12 years from now, and then exponentially go into sharp decline. We also are moving back south. Black people from the last three generations, baby boomers, Xs, and millennials are moving back south. They're moving to Nevada. They're moving to Dallas. They're moving to places like Georgia, North Carolina. And this is the reality. And And what I was given that elaborate breakdown of say, Huey out here in Oakland and King down in Atlanta, and misreading all of that, is what we've done in the past is not understood what's happening amongst our people. People keep saying they're wiping us out. No, they're not. We're growing. And they're saying, mm-hmm. you know, this or that. Black people, can we take over the South the way the Republic of New Africa said so? And if we can we take over electoral districts and actually create a black party in the South to challenge the Democrats in the South? We can't win with a black party nationally, but you sure can create a local black party in communities where there's strong black majorities and challenge them. This is what Harold Washington did successfully in Chicago. The Chicago black nationalists in the South Side, they challenged the National Democrats and basically ran an independent party strategy under the title Democrats, but it was really a black independent party in Chicago that got Harold Washington elected. Are those strategies possible for us in the future instead of simply voting for Democrats and avoiding Republicans?
I agree with you. And also with Du Bois and Garvey's ideologies, I think that in order to liberate ourselves, we're going to have to adapt both of those strategies.
Yes.
We're going to have one foot in their camp, and then, you know what I'm saying, we got to be cunning.
Right.
Just
that's
as
right.
He's cunning, we got to play the same hypocrisy game he play, we have to play that game too.
In Black American tradition, it's called the trickster.
Exactly.
Uncle, you know, Br'er Rabbit, going back to the songs of the South, Uncle Remus stories, man, our people been fooling. I mean, we've been running game on them.
Exactly. All right, brother. Thank you. I'll continue.
All right, my brother.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
And Ellie, before you go to the next caller or develop it, I'd like to just touch with something that Professor Taylor raised, because I think that what you raised earlier when you were talking about how Cruz was making reference about local leadership.
Yeah.
And in each locale, there is specific local leadership.
Right.
I think as if the demographics and the reality of our political philosophy is to move to a certain area, we have to put in place a structure where these different leadership positions can be able to negotiate. Because that's what I think that when you look over the history, especially when you talk about the pre-NAACP, when you talk about Monroe Trotter and T. Thomas Fortin and what they were dealing with, the Afro-American League and then the Equal Rights League that was present even before that, these were structures that were ran and governing mechanisms specifically for that African Americans of different ideological positions came together, even the Negro conventions, right? And they could have been able to hash things out.
Right.
We don't have that. And what white liberals did was co-opt the ability of creating those formations where these different leadership people and positions can come and then create policy and strategy.
That's right. And this is where the white liberal comes into the sharp criticism, because they undermine the confidence of black folk to do this on their own.
Right.
And almost require that we check with them for permission to be, you know, to have agency before we act.
Yep.
And that's part of the challenge of what, you know, Cruz is trying to promote, is that we, you know, look at our own history and build confidence based on what we know we have achieved. And we have some incredible historical achievements as a people, again, political, economic, and cultural in this country, that give us enough to draw on to move forward. And what he argued was, we let World War II and the Great Depression, he says that the Black Power Civil Rights Generation, they let World War II and Great Depression confuse them in terms of understanding their direct connection to it. So they were reproducing in the 1960s some of the same things that black folk had already done in those previous three stages of political, economic, and cultural development in three stages. And so we should have built on that. And so now we're wallowing in the post-civil rights I guess we could even say post-Obama era now, most of us without any sense of direction about what our black politics should look like, Black Lives Matter rose up and made some noise, and it's still, I guess, out there somewhere, waiting for the next brother to get shot to react. There's no real affirmative agenda. So we have Cornel West and Ta-Nehisi Coates, largely the two most, widely listened to of, you know, contemporary thinkers, amongst Black Americans, going at it over, you know, theoretical questions, but not a program. Cornel West is not coming after Ta-Nehisi Coates over a program. Cornel West is coming after Ta-Nehisi Coates over how Ta-Nehisi Coates should talk. And that's not an agenda. That's not a plan. That's not a program. That's not an institution. And it would seem to me that if we had understood what we had done well as a people, we would have more confidence to understand we have a power to go forward in this country in ways that other groups just don't have the knowledge. And I would say that in the sense that if you look at the book by Gerald Horn, he wrote a book about the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. He explained that the American Revolution was actually a counter-revolution against abolition. I'll say that again. The American Revolution was a anti-abolition revolution. It was against the European grain, where the Europeans were moving more and more under the British in the 1830s, the French, for abolition of their slaves and colonies. The Americans were doubling down and weren't going to let go for another 30 years. And then the Brazilians let go, I think, in the 1880s last. And so one of the things that Gerald Horn gives us, and this is just an example of how we as Black people don't appreciate who we are in this country and our own history and draw on it for building our own program here. And what I mean by that is this. Horn shows, for example, that the true revolution of American history was not the anti-British, reaction of the 4th of July, et cetera, 1776. The true revolution, he argues, was Black men, 200,000 former slaves and degraded human beings, standing up one day, taking muskets, standing up with bayonets, and going and killing white men en masse. We saw the movie Glory with Denzel Washington. That, to him, Gerald Horn, was a revolution. It was a revolutionary reality for white men to see Black men rise up against them in ways that we as modern Blacks can't appreciate. It was ghostly and fearsome for white Southerners for Black men to take on arms and uniforms and authority. And so instead of us looking past our own revolutions, for example, in Africa or elsewhere, you know, there's an American Revolution in the Civil War that we effected as a people. When 200,000 Black men got in uniform, they were the difference in the outcome of the war. And both Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln knew the Negro was going to be the difference. And we don't even celebrate our role in the American Civil War, which was our Black Revolution. And this is based, again, on the solid scholarship of Gerald Horn. And I would recommend it for anyone looking to understand this interpretation of the Black Revolution in America. That would be the source. And he outlines this. And brothers, what if we as young people knew this about ourselves? What if our great-grandmothers and grandfathers knew this about themselves? How far along would we be in our confidence? And I think that's where, you know, we have to understand the intentionality behind undermining our confidence. As one of you said earlier, no matter what is put out there, there's always this attempt to undermine it.
Let's grab this call. 773.
You got me, brother?
Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you, brother. Thanks for taking this call. And it's always good to hear you, brothers, and to hear Brother Taylor.
Thank you.
Yeah, Brother Taylor, it's always good to hear you. I'm going to make a few comments here. As far as leadership and Coates and Brother West, all people have and have had disagreements as it relates to leadership and the direction that leadership should take. All people go through that. Right. That comes with being human. Right. But eventually, history and time will show without a doubt as to who or what direction was the correct path, right, as it did with the great Marcus Garvey.
Right.
Now, Brother Taylor, I disagree that we are not being wiped out. Many of us do not see it because it's like the frog in the pot of water that's slowly being turned up. And when he realized that that is a boiling water, it is too late for him to hop out.
Right.
We do not have safety. We do not have security in this white supremacy country. When a people, Brother Taylor, do not have security and safety, they have nothing. Now, on Du Bois. Du Bois was against Marcus Garvey Back to Africa movement. And we know Du Bois came to his senses later on, got out of here, went back to Africa, where he died.
Right.
Garvey, Brother Taylor, had the only real answer for us.
Right.
Today, we are coming up on 100 years since Garvey said, if we did not get out of here, return to Africa, reclaim Africa for us and the Africans. Garvey said in the 1920s, if we did not do that, they was going to do away with us here, and then they was going to do away with the Africans. We're coming up on 100 years to tell us or show us if Garvey was right.
Right.
Now, I say Garvey was right when I look back over them 100 years. How are you going to participate and move forward in a country when they enslave you for 400 years, don't pay you no reparation,
right,
burn your towns, steal, take all your inventions, terrorize you, lynch you in the street, criminalize you, your women, and your children to this day? How you going to move forward in a country like that? That's impossible. Garvey was right. And even Du Bois saw it later on. He left. And this is where we find ourselves, Professor. And I know you're a guy in school and all in teaching, and you have to give that positive outlook. But our people going to have to face reality here, brother.
Right.
The people we are dealing with, Professor, and you know it, but you never say it, they are psychopaths. These people are mentally ill. Yes, sir?
No, go ahead.
These people are mentally ill. They lynched us in the public square, took their children to the lynching, played music, laughed, took pictures, cut off our genitals, took them home, put them in a jar. These people are sick. The boy they got in that White House, Donald Hitler Mussolini dump, he is a psychopath.
Yeah.
And he's going down the same road as Hitler. Hitler did not overthrow the German power structure. Pay attention, people. German power structure put Hitler in office do what he did.
That's right.
This boy here was put in to do exactly what he's doing. And he's creating an atmosphere of violence and chaos against black people. An atmosphere or things gone crazy. That's the atmosphere, Professor.
Yeah,
you must have to exterminate our people.
Yeah.
And we are playing with it. And it is not to be played with.
Right.
And I know many people don't see it, and that's good. That's okay. But be aware, we are dealing with the most dangerous people that have ever walked the planet. They are not stopped. They haven't stopped. And they're going to keep turning it up. And we are next, Professor, on their menu.
Brother X, Thank you as always.
Yes, sir.
Thank you as always for your call, man.
But thank you, brother. I appreciate it.
Thank Peace. You. No, I, you know, I, Elliot, I have said from the beginning of this election that Donald Trump's election was the reversal of everything of the past 50 years that might be identified as progressive, whatever that might mean in the American context, whatever it was. The social safety net, for example, he talked about the Social Security and things of that sort, of us not being safe. I, you know, again, the numbers show what the numbers show. We aren't being wiped out, but I will agree with the brother and his passion in saying that I do believe cultural genocide is possible. That doesn't mean we get wiped out, but that means we get affected a certain way by the effect by affecting our culture.
Oh, most definitely.
Especially us, because our kids both act yellow. All the, you know, even now, I tell my young sons just about the amazing creativity of Black people. How here we are in the 21st century, we still making up music, we still influencing the culture, we still influence pretty much the world through our culture, and we don't control it. But if we did, we could change our predicament in America. And so I do agree that cultural genocide is possible. This is what the Canadians apologized to the First Nations about, was cultural genocide, recognizing that even when you don't erase a people, you can affect them and, you know, exterminate aspects of their culture. And so that is important. And for Black America, if we don't have our culture, we don't have much else in terms of our productivity. And so this is something I think we have to be aware of when we're talking about Black leaders and Black programs. I'm not interested in debates between scholars or a social movement, you know, of Black people making appeals to white people that doesn't have its base in the Black community. In terms of this cultural genocide idea, I do believe that is possible. But our numbers are growing, and I'm interested in how it is that and ways that we can accept that reality and try to figure out how to make it work for ourselves with some intentionality, because right now we're just sort of organized around the Democratic Party,
you know,
and that's our politics.
And you know, let me bring this up, because we've had representatives from the Black Coffee Party down in New Orleans, the United African People's Organization over there in Missouri, the Black is Back Coalition of Omawale Ishiteli, and also the 1 Million Conscious Black Voters and Contributors, right, with James Klingman and Brother Amafika. All of them advocate some type of, and I'm going to coin the term that Kali Acuna and them use, a Black Belt politics.
Right.
Where we have independent Black representation. Now,
right,
it always, and that's why it's important to me, myself and Brother Richard, we always talk about the importance of think tanks in all of these areas, whether it be urban or suburban where we dwell, because we need to talk about our situation in a real time talk to our children and to our families. Now, it's always a reality check that happens to our people whenever they think that they're progressing in some sort of fashion. Now, I'm saying that to say this. I want to give two examples. Earlier in the past couple of weeks, the media, even though Black people put Doug Jones into office, the media took an opportunity to drive a wedge, and they kept saying Black women did it, Black women did it, Black women did it, when over 90% of Black women and men voted for Jones. Now, here's two examples of you think you're taking one step forward, but you're taking three steps back. Let me read something to you to kind of set up what I'm talking about. And it's an historical moment, but it's right back in our faces now. This is September 19th, 1868. Camilla, Georgia, long before Bloody Sunday in Selma. Selma, Georgia, had a much bloodier civil rights event. The Camilla Massacre was on September 19, 1868. During Reconstruction, the political rally in Mitchell County resulted in dozens of freedmen being killed and over 30 others wounded. Georgia had just been readmitted to the Union, but blacks and whites remained deeply divided. In early September, while Democrats in the Georgia legislature expelled all 28 African-American members, in response, one of those members, Philip Joyner from Southwest Georgia, led several hundred freedmen on a march from Albany to Camilla for a Republican rally. As the marchers entered the courthouse square, the sheriff and other local whites opened fire. Violence sent a clear message. Many black voters stayed home for the presidential election 2 months later, but the Camilla massacre made national headlines and prompted Congress to return Georgia to a military occupation. Now, this was in 1868 in Camilla, Georgia. Let's fast forward to now. Camilla, Georgia, all the city hall employees, except three, are black, the custodian and two ticket takers. 97% of the African Americans who applied for jobs inside City Hall have been rejected. The town hall employs no African American police officers. 99% of all white students attend a historically all white private school in town. 99% of all African American students attend the public school in town. And the city is 70% black. What is wrong? Now, wait a minute. Now, hold it. What is wrong with our thinking? Here's an example of what's wrong with our thinking. Listen to what the mayor that did, because it made national news when he couldn't get keys to get in City Hall. Listen to what he says in this interview. And this is, by and large, the problem with our people's thinking in dealing with our situation. Listen to the clip.
It's Thursday. It might as well be What the Hell Thursday. And what the hell is going on in Camilla, Georgia? Black Mayor Rufus Davis put out a press release saying he has begun a nonviolent resistance campaign by sitting out of city council meetings to call attention to discriminatory and segregation practices in education, employment, and law enforcement. Even one of the city's cemeteries is segregated. Joining us right now is Mayor Rufus Davis and his attorney, civil rights attorney, Ben Crump. Mayor, what the hell?
Good morning, sir. Yes, it's almost something out of the Twilight Zone.
So they won't even give you the keys? Explain this.
Sure. Let me just kind of contextualize it. I was elected as the first African-American male mayor in my city in November of 2015. At that time, I ran on a platform of diversity and inclusion. But ever since, I've been met with a strong resistance. And I feel that it was more of a, you know, an attempt to silence the voice of the people that I represent. So the denial of the keys was pretty much a denial of access to representation by the African-American supermajority in my city.
And explain to people how segregated this city is in 2017 as we head into 2018.
Sure. My city is 70% black. However, the only city-owned cemetery is segregated. There's a black section and a white section. It's divided by a fence that serves as the demarcation line. On the black side, there are no burial records. No one will know where their loved ones are buried if someone can't tell them from memory. And it's in stark contrast to the white side. There are no black police officers. I have no black professional men employed in City Hall. The highest job held by an African-American male is that of meter reader. All city hall employees are white except three, which includes this custodian. 99% of all white students who attend school attend the historically all-white public, all-white private school. And 99% of all black students attend the underfunded public school. And Mr. Martin, this system is maintained because of severe political, severe racial gerrymandering, whereas my city is ruled by a small white minority that has been able to consolidate their voting power because they've created a white voting district where essentially 90% or more of all whites are packed into one voting district, which allows them to pretty much guarantee almost control of the city council.
You, of course, have hired Ben Crump. Ben Crump, this is just unbelievable, but this is trying to get people to understand that in parts of this country, you are still dealing with Jim Crow era.
Roland, it is incredible when you think about these white leaders who still worry about when they die, they don't want to be buried next to a black person. It's almost as if they think it's a black heaven and a white heaven, and they're going to find themselves in an integrated hell. We are believing that if we get this fence taken down, that desegregated fence, dividing the dead, then we can start to tackle desegregating the city departments that separate the living. And it's going to be a fight to take this fence down. It's very symbolic, Roland, so we need everybody, all your audience, to know, like they took down that Berlin Wall, we're going to take down this fence in Camilla, Georgia.
Mayor Davis, final question. What's next?
Well, we'd like to bring down the fences of the of segregation in my cemetery. We'd like to take down fences of
I'll cut it right there. But, Brother Richard, Professor Taylor, therein lies the issue and the problem. The gentleman that won for mayor, Rufus Davis, said that he ran on a platform of inclusion and diversity in a city that's 70% black, with no economic base. The people that patrol the neighborhoods are not black. And you ran on a platform of of diversity and inclusion. And your whole mission now is to be buried next to white folks to get a fence taken down. Right. What is wrong with some of our thinking?
Right.
It's like the book by Dr. Jerome Fox, Addicted to White. It's something wrong with our thinking. And these are the people that we elect. Somebody wants diversity and inclusion in a city that's 70% black, that had a history of brutalizing black people, and still doing the same thing over 100 years later. I just read an account where a little over 100 years ago, they had a massacre down there of black people that wanted to vote after they were ushered out of their elected seats. And they were met with gunfire.
Yeah.
So the basic environment of that town haven't changed in over 100 years.
That's right.
So Ben Crump is going to go down there and get them to take a fence down so you can be buried next to white folks. And this guy can't even get the keys to his office. But right. He ran on a policy, a platform of inclusion and diversity. That's the problem. Our people are not using their head. They're not thinking. They want to get close to white folks instead of looking out for what's best for our people and our community.
Well, you know, it does line up to with the same condition in Alabama, because they're, and as you say, Professor Taylor, not necessarily have an agenda. But what I don't hear, and I take as understanding too, that we have to consider, is what you also say in relationship to the leadership that's local, because right. I'm assuming that the people 100 years later do not have the economic infrastructure to support their own self, to give them the power to actually move the political reality. What I'm trying to say is I'm assuming, just like 100 years ago, a lot of those people are living off of the largesse of the whites who hire them,
mm-hmm.
which keeps the political relationships the same. Right. And therefore the population and the local leadership, black, have to decide how do we move this along, which is the same issue if we look at I'm assuming it's the same issue when we look at our, look at the political leadership, the black political class, because we don't have an economic foundation. when you talk about the Democratic Party, we right. know that the Democratic Party has not financed its natural constituency, which is the Black constituency.
That's right.
As from an organizing position. And the Black people who are part of that Democratic Party are not saying anything when it comes from the local elections to the state elections to the national election, and making us think of why aren't you spending those millions of dollars to fund your natural base?
Right.
Now, isn't that scene sounds the same thing as the condition, but you'll hear them say, we're all included. And push that as a supposedly a Democratic agenda, even if they're on the Hillary and the Bill soul train.
Right.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny you mentioned Doug Jones, because that was my next person I was going to mention. After he won in office and Black folks claimed the victory because they pushed him over the hump, one of the first things he said was he was willing to go down there and work with Trump.
That's right.
And then he told people to listen, let's move forward, because the allegations of Trump sexually harassing women has been coming to the surface. He said, well, we need to table that stuff. Let's move forward. Let's not focus in on that. Now a report comes out that all his senior staff is white.
Mm-hmm.
So all the Black folks in Alabama that was claiming victory, and it seemed like it was Blacks all over the country that was claiming victory. What victory? What's going on down in Lowndes County, Alabama, is a disgrace. And we talked about that last week on the program, Dr. Taylor. Lowndes County is a historic county as far as Black folks are concerned.
Right. Right.
But that raw sewage that's pouring into the county, and they can't get help for it. The city, the local and state governments talking about, well, it's an issue that you have to take care of. If you lived in the city, you wouldn't have to deal with it. But you live in a rural area, so it's up to you. Leave Black folks holding the bag. That's a disgrace. Those things should have been on the table if they were voting for this guy, Doug Jones. What you going to do about this situation in Lowndes County? Evidently, Black folks didn't have anything on the table. But before I get your response to that.
We can't change the arrangement, because we don't have the kind of power nexus to be able to, even if the person said, I'm going to do it, to you, because you have to have a mechanism of enforcement, right? And if you don't have a mechanism of enforcement, a person will sell you anything, you know, and you'll believe that they are going to do it. But then when they get in, they looking at where the power really lie, and they'll align themselves with that. Again, looking at the what we say, Black leadership, even at the civil rights leadership, that power line for them, those leaders, correct me if I'm wrong, was about that they got $1 million, $1.5 million. Right. Black people didn't come up with $1.5 million at that point in time. So we have to be conscientious of how this structure, when we say leadership, we also are looking at, and I'm generalizing, but I'm personalizing, we have to look at ourselves in the sense of we have to be able to support. And that was the difference of after the Civil War, Black people did, and I think you mentioned that, Professor Taylor, Black people did. They built those schools. They built those cooperatives. They bought all that farmland. Yep. They did that. If it wasn't for them, Booker T couldn't have done it. Tuskegee.
That's right. And it's really, you know, right before us again, you know, we have the development of Jackson, Mississippi right now. And I think that's something we have to keep our eyes on and keep, you know, our positive thoughts and prayers in support of, because it's important in the way that I was explaining earlier, that Cruz says that we just misread our movement and began, you know, creating chaos by everybody thinking they were going to be the leader of whatever revolution or transformation or reforms were going to happen, instead of everyone staying in their own lane and developing their own circumstance. If Jackson is successful as a progressive city that we all know has roots in the philosophy and ideology of Black nationalism and based on the beliefs of Chukwuemeka Lumumba and the Republic of New Africa, his history and its history with, I want to say, Imari Obadeli, if I'm mistaken,
Yes.
No, I'm sorry. Was it Mario Badelli?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, right. Okay, thank you. Right. That's right. That's right. You know, this was something that was, you know, important, I think, you know, to put forward. And I think we still, I mean, the success of Ta-Nehisi Coates, we have to keep in mind, at least, you know, the way in which he captured everyone's attention was through this essay detailing the impact of Jim Crow and other forms of discrimination on Black people economically way after slavery. And so, you know, reparations, I think, going back to our original discussion of the 13th and 14th Amendment, has to continue to be a part of any kind of Black agenda. Even if you don't think and believe in literal reparations, to me, the charge of reparations remain important to make because Black Americans have an unresolved claim against this society and against this against the American state. And for it to double down with this sort of neo-segregationist moment with Donald Trump's election, I see Donald Trump's election as significant. If you study the history of South Africa, there was a man named Hendrik Voorwerd, Voorvord, and he's like this well-known national figure in South Africa for the white nationalists, the Afrikaners, and they admire him as their national hero. And Voorwerd isn't the first guy to be elected in about 1948, but the first guy who is, they basically, you know, established the nationalist agenda. But it's Voorwerd who comes along and really gives apartheid its full character. And I think of Donald Trump as that kind of figure. I think Donald Trump is a horrible racist backlash. He is not, I'm saying he is the consequence of a racist backlash. That's not even a backlash. It's just a blink. It's just an everyday blink. In fact, we shouldn't be using backlash because that's an awful analogy for us. But my point is, it's more like a blink because, you know, it basically reset the racial order that the perception of Barack Obama's election disrupted for many people psychologically, even though in terms of policy positions, there's nothing that they can point to where Barack Obama's actually done anything that was Black specific or benefited Black people in any specific way. And in social index after social index after social index, some of your audience may not want to hear this, but there's wide research now showing that across the board in every major category, Black America was the only group to go backwards in the Obama era. In every major category where all groups were being looked at in terms of general group progress or social progress, Black America went backwards. Everyone else didn't. Everyone else didn't. And there's something deeply wrong with that. And so if we were simply comforted by Barack Obama as a brown-skinned man and by his wife, the beautiful Michelle Obama, you know, for psychological and symbolic purposes, I guess that has its point. But in terms of a kind of, you know, transformation of Black life, of course, it was transformed, but in a negative way. And that's one of the things we aren't even beginning to really understand, is that Donald Trump is the reaction, I think, that whites had as a fear of whatever Obama was the tipping point of, this browning of America. And they were willing to give him the power of the office in order to make themselves feel like this place was familiar to them again, even if he's acting in ways that are completely unfamiliar in office. Many whites found I felt like after Trump was elected, many whites felt like many Blacks were celebrating when Barack Obama was elected, that they were like they had somehow been restored as a people. And hard top hat wearing white men, you know, here in the Bay Area, I saw all around me seemed to have an extra pep in their step and more confidence in public spaces than they had during the Obama era. And so, you know, Donald Trump is that Voorwerd figure for me. He's that figure who I've told people here in many public forums. I've been at, you know, the Commonwealth Club, of many different forums here in the Bay Area, that Donald Trump to me is that once in a generation kind of a figure like Henrik Vorwerg who reverses history. And I'm not, when you say apartheid, I take it seriously. I take seriously that Donald Trump is the tipping point of a reversal of whatever perception black people had in their progress as since the civil rights movement in trying to protect Reconstruction. And that's really what we were doing with civil rights, was trying to protect Reconstruction. Is we are now in the midst of one of the most uncertain periods in black history with Donald Trump in office.
And I think that plays into the whole notion of from the, what we have to put back in that equation, the capitalist perspective of this system, because after Roosevelt did the redistribution of wealth from the wealthy to the working right. class, whites and blacks, and blacks being the, you know, undergirding of the capitalist system. So you can only expect so much, but whites didn't get anything. And here, say from the 70s, you know, through Ronald Reagan, they've been trying to reverse that's right. that. And that's right. here now, Trump is the final cultural popular on the cultural popular line of white supremacy to be able to get an acceptance of it. But at the systemic level of the capitalism to reverse back the wealth back to the wealthy
that's
class.
Right. That's right.
You know, that's very astute.
That's very astute analysis. Because I do believe that Reagan was the, you know, sort of tribune of this notion of, you know, reversing the role, you know, big government, you know, and Grover Norquist, right? The idea right. that you put the government so small that it'll fit into a bathtub was his idea when he went after Bush II, Bush the father, after no new taxes. You're right, Reagan, you know, started it. And Trump is basically, they're still, what we're both saying is they're still at war with FDR.
Right.
And the New Deal. And the big idea that big government, that government should provide a basic safety net to citizens. Donald Trump this week took that concept and turned it on its head and had a major political party underwrite this notion that you can take $1.5 trillion. And instead of building the country up and the infrastructure up, you build up a economic group who's already economically advantaged. And so, you know, race is going to continue to be a factor in this country for another 200-300 years. And Donald Trump is going to, I think, play the role now in trying to reassure white America in its decline. In its numerical and cultural decline, that if you hold your nose and support his revanchist agenda, that they will ultimately benefit from this. And so many people are confused about the bipolar experience of Donald Trump on one hand and then trying to believe in what you used to believe about America in another, and then trying to understand the role of white women voters in Alabama and in the national election, and then trying to understand race and gender and all of this stuff going on. And it's like the chaos of our politics are reflected in this moment. And we're finding out that, you know, all the white feminists aren't down with civil rights or with, you know, or with black people or with brown people, you know, that they are they're voting with their men. And they've been doing this for 50 years, and we keep seeing it for 50 years. We keep seeing white women for 50 years have voted for the Republican Party in the majority, and we keep acting surprised that white women are supporting a man who was expressed hostile, anti-women rhetoric, out loud. And when this country voted for him after, you know, he made these statements on this Access Hollywood tape, it pretty much gave him permission to behave the way he now behaves in office. because they said we're willing to accept anything from you as long as we get a white man back in that white in the White House. Mm-hmm. And that is the price we are now paying. Donald Trump is white people's middle finger to the concept of black people's post-racialism or this whole idea of a multicultural or browning America. I said this on live television here in San Francisco, that Donald Trump was the middle finger of white voters to the rest of us.
Let's go to 646. 646.
Hey, good evening, brothers. How are y'all good brothers doing?
Hey, bro. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. Listen, number one, let's address the dog on the table for what it is. Black people in this country are losing their strength and power each and every day. You know, we go out here and we give our vote to white men like Doug Jones, and Doug Jones go out there and get elected to office, and he turn around and bend over and tell us to kiss his behind. Now, there was just a statement posted today or a couple of days ago talking about he's not putting no blacks on his senior staff. Now, the most he could do or the least he could do is give a Negro 30% of right. the jobs on his staff. Number one. Now, if you can't get that, there's no reason whatsoever for him to ever get any support from black folks. But what black folks will do is they'll hem and haw, and they'll listen to these radio hosts and these other job turkey reverends, as I refer to pork chop chicken eaters, and go along with the program and give up your vote again. But I'm going to tell you something, and I want y'all to remember this. In the key states that will determine the president in 2020, it will not be the blacks who they think will have the final say-so. It will be the Baba Louie. And the Baba Louie is a whole different type animal than any of these other ethnic groups. They believe in tribalism at the highest order when you screw them over. And what has just happened to them in Puerto Rico, like the governor said, we are going to put some payback. And believe me, they are organized enough to be able to go into strategic states and make the necessary difference and smile up in the Negro's face and act like they are friends and in the process turn around and stab us in the back. See, the Negro don't understand what he's dealing with when he's dealing with the Urugu and this Baba Louie. And they're going to play us. And when 2020 comes along, after whatever so-called coalition comes into play in 2018, it's going to be the beginning of our total downfall. Because between now and then, black folks ain't coming together in their interest. They're coming together to put the Urugu in office to find the Urugu who's going to be more kinder to them, who's not going to do what Trump's doing. See, the bottom line with Trump is, and what I think a lot of us don't realize is, he has already fulfilled his gift. Now, it depends on what type of threat they perceive him to be around the world will determine how they're going to get rid of him. But remember, and let's be very, very clear, he's done his job already. Because his job was to make the white man feel good after having Puff the Magic Negro in office and to do these tax cuts that he just did to transfer the degree of wealth that he has in this country that is basically going to wreak havoc by 2019.
Yep.
So, you know, the reality is we as black people, we want to integrate too much with this Urugu. We want to be a part of them. him to love us and respect us and all of this. And I'm going to say this. Martin Luther King is turning over in his grave in utter disgust. Because remember, before the man saw his maker, it looked like he had waked up and seen that the disastrous situation that he had placed us in. Because if you think about it, all of those Negroes who was with Martin Luther King at his highest echelon and those a little bit lower have become what?
Rich.
Negroes.
Yep.
Rich Negroes. You understand? I heard this Negro, Jesse Jackson, talking about he looking for money to help him with his treatment because he got Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or whatever the hell he got. Let me explain this to y'all Negroes. Jesse Jackson is a very rich man. His family has distribution in other businesses which in Chicago generates millions of dollars that his son Yusuf runs. You understand what I'm saying? Have you ever heard Jesse Jackson having a job? Don't you see every year he's having a so-called Wall Street Summit, and who pays for that? Wall Street? Now, y'all Negroes want to go out there and give that bastard a dime of your money. It's like giving Omar Johnson your money. And you could see what's happening right now with old brother fraud daddy Omar. But what I'm saying is all of this is this. This is the deal. If we don't wake up and understand who our enemy is, we are going to be a lost people, because the way things are changing in this country with the economy, industrialization, all sorts of things, the white man has no more use for us.
Right.
He has no use for us. You understand? And the sad thing is, if you think that politics is going to change our condition, you sadly mistaken, because every time you put a Yerugu in office, all he do is turn around and tell you to kiss his butt. And when you put a Negro in office, he don't do nothing for you. And the bottom line is, the one thing I'm convinced now more than everything that black people need, we need a damn lobbyist. Because the lobbyist just basically changed the total economic direction in this country.
That's right,
Jay.
6,000 of them did, and that, you know, and they wrote the legislation, and now we got to deal with that reality, for sure.
And Brother Taylor, let me ask you this: you just had the mayor in Chicago drop dead. Now they got a black woman, I think, as the new mayor, right?
No,
now, you know, San Francisco, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay, now think about this. I know I'm going to get in trouble, but I don't care no more. You got a Negress that is the new Barack Obama, basically coming into play, Kamala Harris. How did, right. And be honest, how did Kamala Harris come into the public eye as nothing more than a bedwitch of Willie Brown? Now, how do you go from being the bedwitch of the mayor, Willie Brown, to being a senator and all of this, and you think that Negress is going to do something to help African people? And she got a Yerugu on her arm? But she's your now new savior? You at least made Barack Obama have a black woman.
Yeah, she used to say she was black, and then all of a sudden it changed. Now she's Jamaican-American. Yeah, now she's Jamaican-American and Indian-American now, not black American. She's no longer African-American. But as I understand...
Elliot likes Jamaican food a lot, so I guess that's why he'll give her his vote. And I know Richard is a man that enjoys Indian cuisine. But, you know, the bottom line, I leave y'all on this. We in trouble, and I thank you so much, Brother Taylor, for coming on this show and the Carl Nelson show and trying to school our people into the madness that we're dealing with. But you know something? Anytime you are more concerned about losing a Roland Martin show and not understanding the science behind them keeping a bunch of Negro women talking nonsense and taking away someone who has issues and giving us political waking up, then you know we're in trouble. And right. You do nothing about it as a people. You don't make no type of demands on Kathy Hughes, who talks about how much she loves black people. But you know something? Ask her how well she pays her employees. And ask her about all of the white people that are basically in control of why she's in the economic position that she's in. You know, Kathy Hughes is like most of these Negroes out here. She's about a dollar, and she ain't got no love for African people. As long as she can have her position up with the Urugu, she all right. Have a good night, brother.
Peace. Thank you, sir.
And enjoy Kwanzaa. Forget about Christmas. Enjoy Kwanzaa. Black power.
Yes, sir.
Peace, Jay.
Power to the people.
Let's go to 215. 215.
Yeah, hey, how Brother Elliot, how you doing?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Hey, Brother Richard, how you doing, good brother?
All right, now, how you feeling?
I'm doing all right. Hey, Brother Teller, how you doing? It's an honor to talk to you, Brother Teller. How you feeling, good brother?
I'm doing fine.
Our praise be to Allah. I'm doing well. You know, Brother Teller, after Jay, I'm going to be perfectly honest with y'all, brothers. How do you follow Brother Jay? Can y'all give me some advice? He's a hard act to follow. but what he was saying was real. I don't agree with Jay on something, but on tonight, Brother Jay was fired up, and he was and everything he said, Brother Teller, he was spot on, man.
No, I agree. I was taking notes.
Yes, sir. I just want to make this comment, Brother Teller. You know, as I discussed with Brother Elliot early in the week and stuff, see, once again, Brother Teller, we as black folks, and Jay kind of hinted on it somewhere in this conversation, we got poor black leadership in this country. When I say poor black leadership, I mean we got it on a federal level, we got it on the state level, especially here in Pennsylvania where me, Brother Richard, and Brother Elliot live, and definitely here on a local level when we got the so-called city council and them Negroes and their foolishness, and on the state level with these state reps and state senators, they're disgracing this life and the next. And I say that, Brother Teller, with all due honesty, on the federal level, because once again, if we had strong black leadership, what you've seen in Alabama this past couple of weeks where with the predominantly black women that put Doug Jones in office when he beat that racist cracker down in Alabama. It was predominantly black women vote. And what did black people get out of their vote? Doug Jones, instead of him being thankful for the black women that voted for him and the Democrat Party, they still catering for the so-called Reagan Democrats. They still looking for the white middle class, so-called white Reagan Democrats, white working class. Instead of them, they should be kissing black people behind for putting Doug Jones in office. But again, Brother Teller, if you had strong black leadership on the federal level, we would have used our vote for a bargaining chip. When we got Negroes that all they want to do is be part of the Democrat Party and don't get a damn thing for our vote, this is why we continue to be behind the eight ball. So Doug Jones, the Democrat Party, so we got them Negroes in our back pocket. They won't vote for us anyway, no matter what. So we can go ahead and cater to the so-called Reagan Democrats and the Dixiecrats or whatever. Instead of catering to their base, which is probably black women and in some cases black men. So we once again get played.
No, I agree, and that to me is the real challenge. Is one thing to win an election. It's another thing to turn that into politics. And like you say, leadership, that's where leadership comes into play. That if the local black leadership, I heard, as I understood it, the NAACP in Alabama played a key role in mobilizing black people to get out. It should be in the position now of sitting down with Democrats in Alabama with Doug Jones and saying, here's what we want. We want institutions. We want money for our schools. We want Alabama State funded. We want you to support us in Shelby versus Holder to get to restore the Voting Rights Act, which happened there in Alabama, and to make other demands on him, both in terms of resources and in terms of politics, because he can't simply play to the white. He's got to play to the white voters. He's going to play to the white. Because he got to balance between black Alabama and red Alabama. But I think it's politics is where black politics, it's like you said, at the national level, if the Congressional Black Caucus had behaved more outrageously, like the Tea Party elements did in 2010, when they were dissatisfied with Obama, when they were troubled by Obama, they lost their minds and they acted up. But the Congressional Black Caucus, you know, in face of Flint, in the face of Detroit Water, I mean, in the face of the police, you know, killing, they've been too civil and they've been too well behaved. And yet we saw these town hall meetings 7 years ago where this country was disrupted by this white reaction. And yet the leadership is largely very well behaved. And this, to me, is part of the problem.
You're right, Brother Teller, because right here, I make these last couple of comments and I'll get off. Right here in Philadelphia, Brother Teller, about 7 years ago, I was outraged as a 56-year-old black man. We had about 35 unarmed, not armed, but unarmed black men got murdered by the police in Philadelphia.
Wow.
And one of them was the nephew of former Mayor Wilson Good, the first black mayor who presided over the move bombing. And guess what? Only one black elected official opened up their mouth. Ain't nobody say nothing. And many of these black people, as you know, Brother Teller, they got sons, they got daughters, they got nephews, they got fathers, they got brothers, uncles, whatever, they got black males, and them open up their damn mouth. I mean, I just get so discouraged because it's so sad to see the our poor leadership. But like I said, we have it on the local level, the state level, federal level. These niggas, all they is about a paycheck. Like Brother Jay say, all they want to do is sweetheart with the European, you know, make niceties to him. As long as they're getting their paycheck, they don't want to rock the boat and stuff like that. I mean, it's just sad. And as long as we keep on putting these kind of individuals in office, Brother Teller, whether it be on a city or state or federal level,
But that's why I think we have to, you know, highlight cases like Jackson, Mississippi, when they emerge. I mean, I would like to talk about Newark, but I don't know what's going on with Newark, New Jersey, with Ross Baraka. But, of course, he's also got similar ideological commitments as Chukwe Lumumba and the brothers and sisters do down there in Jackson. But those folk, under his teaching, under Chukwe's teaching, and now his sons, they are trying to do something different as an example for black Mississippi and black America. And we have to... If we could afford to chip in and help down there, send money down there in some way or resources. In other words, we need some successes. This is what the Panthers were trying to do originally, was give us some examples on what is possible. And we need some success stories on what is possible here in America, because Cruz says, at this point, if we hadn't done something more independent by the year 2000, he said back in 1986, he projected in 1986 that if we didn't do something more independent as a people by the year 2000, he said in plural but equal, that we will we've reached the end of black politics by the year 2000 if we haven't created an independent spirit amongst our people in terms of politics. And so we're 17 years past that, and we're at an impasse because even we have witnessed the launching of a massive movement called the Black Lives Matter movement, the biggest thing we've seen since Black Power. And now we're sitting here and we don't know what's going on. We don't know.
Right.
And it's not because we're all older and out of touch. I'm right here in Oakland where Kaepernick and Black Lives Matter were started and Oscar Grant. I'm right here on the front end of all of this stuff.
Yes,
and I'm telling you, I don't know what's going on with the movement.
Brother Teller, you echo my sentiments, Brother Teller. And I just say in closing, Brother Teller, I love a brother like you because I can hear in your voice, your passion, you love our people, you sincere, you want to see our people do better. And I just encourage you, Brother Teller, keep doing what you're doing
and
keep on working up our masses because, like Brother Jay said, like you say too, Brother Teller, we had an impasse and we have got to get our act together because you see the article that was in the black publications like The Final Call and other black magazines. Black people are headed for lifetime poverty as far as wealth is concerned. If we don't change our way of thinking, our ideology, we are headed, we're going to continue, we're going to be always at the last of the ladder. And as one of our callers from Chicago, I don't get as extreme as him, but like you say, he always say, brother from Chicago, Brother X, we almost on the verge of being eliminated because you see the way these people feel about us. Like Jay said, they have the white man no longer use for us no more, and that's why the police have got free car blocks to kill us whenever they want to. So if we don't change our way of thinking and change our mindset, we definitely headed for a very, you know, serious, perilous end. So we have definitely got to for our own survival. And I know I'm not going to be around forever, but just for my future children and stuff right. coming to, after me, I want to see how people get it together because, okay. it, you know, we can't go, in other words, Brother Taylor, we can't afford to stay on the path we stay. We've got to change our direction. Like Brother Elliot and Brother Richard's show, it's time for the wake, and we've got to wake up, man, and change our way of thinking. Now, just thank you, Brother Taylor, for the time. And Elliot, Richard, our brothers, keep up the good work, man.
All right. Yeah. Peace. Let's go to 4-4-1. I'm sorry. 414.
Hey, Brother Elliot. Hey, Brother Richard.
How are you, sir?
Taylor, how y'all doing?
How are you, Brother Osi?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Mm-hmm. I'm just enjoying the conversation. Of course, I have a program on Time for an Awakening, and we talk about the same thing. So the conversation is real. It's unfortunate that our people can't comprehend it and don't understand it. But the only salvation for African people is to unite, period.
Okay.
Just like when Puffy or somebody had that vote or die thing, I think that was when Barack first ran, vote or die, should have been bump vote or die, should have been unify or die, because that's what the bottom line is. If we do not have some functional unity and an understanding that we need to repatriate, we need to get up out of this madness. We continue to believe that somehow we can make these folks respect our humanity, respect and give us dignity and respect and share in what they have stolen, what they have created for themselves. It hasn't happened. It's not happening. And it ain't going to happen. Mm-hmm. But keep holding out hope. Keep hope alive. It's like Professor Taylor did, or somebody did, talking about Jesse Jackson now having a GoFundMe account.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, we must develop a leadership that is nationalistic, that is Pan-Africanist, that is strong. We must develop a cadre of leadership. To me, I wouldn't fund any education that does not speak to that. I would not put any money that doesn't put us to where we must go. The UNCF ain't going to do it. All these other organizations ain't going to do it. It's still trying to beg and plead Caucasians and allow us to be in their institutions. And if we're not in their institutions like UNCF or schools, they're still teaching what Caucasians are teaching.
Mm.
You know,
they're
not teaching our people, those young men and women, to be revolutionary in their thought, to be independent, to be self-determining, to be liberated, to be sovereign. They're not teaching that.
No.
You know, so this leadership must come into existence yesterday. You know, it is a paramount. Look at what's happening globally to African people. Paramount. It ain't just Philly or Milwaukee or Atlanta or New York or San Francisco. No, it's everywhere African people are. We have no friends. We have no friends. But yet there was a period of time, as you guys know, that people came from far and wide to sit at our feet to learn the sciences, the disciplines of knowledge. That at our feet. It is recorded. It is verified. It's not a myth. It's not allegory. It's a fact. But yet, we don't understand it, nor do we embrace it to help us. I mean, you know, but I'm still optimistic, brothers. I'm still very optimistic. And I know I speak about the same thing, what I'm saying right now. So I've been on my program here on Time for an Awakening from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time.
So that's wonderful. It's really important to know.
I would love for you, Professor Taylor, to come on and chop it up with me. Believe me.
Please, just get my information from Elliot. I'd be glad to come on.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
All right, Brother Osi.
Brother Elliot, I just wanted to chime in real quick and make this point that, you know, as a political scientist, I'm able to sort of make statements and see things that other social areas of Black life in America don't see the same kind of unity. There's no other area in life, in black life, outside of maybe religious expression, where you see the kind of unity that you do in black politics. And what I mean by that is black people are overwhelmingly Democrat. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying the fact is we are united in that. We are 99% or 90%+ behind the Democrats. Now, I'm making – that's just an observation. But with that observation, I'm making the point that unlike someone who studies, say, class or someone who studies art and aesthetic expression in black life, or like Eugene Robinson, the Washington Post writer, wrote the book Disintegration, where he saw four or five black Americas emerging, you know, the emergent diversification and diversity of black America, how we're changing and becoming more, you know, sophisticated in terms of our self-understanding as a group. But that doesn't plan out in terms of politics. In politics, we still stick together. Overwhelmingly, we voted 90%+ for this man, Jones. Black women of Alabama did, and black men voted 92%.
Mm-hmm.
And then for Obama, we gave him, I think, 94% the second time, 92% the second time.
96% the first time.
Yeah, about the first time, right. You know. Right, and this begins in 1964 with LBJ getting 94% of the black vote. My point is, we can criticize that, or we can look at it as something that can be built on. I'm saying to you, I'm just trying to get you and the audience to think about this simple point, that we stick together in politics in ways we don't stick together in any other area of black life. We don't have 90% involvement with each other in any other area outside of, you know, that's measurable outside of, you know, family interaction or maybe group association, like voluntary association, maybe the fraternities and the sororities, you know, organizational membership. But my point is that's solid, a solid basis on which to organize and to unite, as the last caller suggested. You know, we have something to work with. Black people do stick together politically in a hostile racist society with limited options. So since we have the potential to stick together politically, and we have 50 years of black people sticking together politically, we have to figure out, as the last caller said, how to tap and develop future black leadership that will realize this and use it to the advantage of black people and their interests, and not to the interests of the individual, you know, leader or black leaders themselves.
Listen, I agree with you, Professor Taylor, but I don't know what it's going to take to get some of our people to realize, because, listen, money drives this system here. It's a capitalist society, and money is money driven, especially in politics. And when they wave dollars in front of white folks' faces, they go crazy. Some black folks, when they wave dollars in front of our people's faces, they lose their mind. I mean, we just got to keep our eyes on the prize, so to speak. And if the prize is our people's sovereignty, our people's freedom, and the welfare of our families and babies, then those things should be paramount.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I would, you know, for the sake of discussion, I would like to see Black Lives Matter turn right now inward. Instead of talking to white folk and making appeals to white people, the Black Lives Matter movement needs to turn to black America and talk to black America, because that was the original conversation in the first place, was that our lives matter. So, so to me, that should be the next move, is black internal black development. Yeah, you still need money, and money would have to be figured out in terms of, you know, black development. But I'm saying, if Black Lives Matter is going to be anything different and not just simply a flirtation with black power, then at some point we need to begin to see them do something. If black folk in Jackson, Mississippi can do something independent and give us an example, Black Lives Matter surely should be able to give us some kind of a tangible thing that we can all look at that is a product of that movement that we can point to, whether it's an institution or the idea that sisters who are part of this movement are now coming back in the community, and we're seeing more volunteerism from these sisters in committed to Black development. In other words, the Black Lives Matter movement should figure out what it wants to do with regard to the Black community. And for me, it would be coming back into the Black community and using all that young energy, all that intelligence, all of that commitment, and try to work from within the community with our young and begin developing a Black urban agenda and a Black urban program in the same way the Panthers throughout the country began to try to develop where they were, because otherwise Black Lives Matter was almost sort of a tease. Like, okay, so you mobilized and you made these moral appeals to whites, but what can we point to that is tangible as a consequence of all your movement? Since you had center stage, we need to be able to point to specifics. And with Black Lives Matter right now, I don't know what we can talk about apart from their demonstrations. And so what I'd like to see Black Lives Matter do ideally is create local Black candidates, to run local Black candidates throughout wherever we are, challenging the Democrats, running independent Black Lives Matter candidates to run against Democrats and Republicans, if for no other reason to put the issues in the debates and put the issues on the record and force Black Democrats to see that the white Democrats will organize with white Republicans to prevent a Black Lives Matter platform from ever being even debated in these public spaces, and then force Black Democrats to make some choices on their own.
And I have to say, I don't, I have a challenge with whether they, their intent was other than what they did. Yeah. And then I raised the other question that you raised earlier about the question of, even if they did, those individuals who are, did join up with Black Lives Matter, when they go to these local communities, the things they have to respect is, one is the local leadership that exists that didn't participate in Black Lives Matter, but does have power nexuses within the communities that they're there, which means that they would have to negotiate to some degree with those right. leaderships within that community. But then there's that third element that it seems to has to, that we, you know, Ellie, you raised with members of the guests that we have, because we need a structure where these different points of view from a political perspective can be able to come and debate and raise the point of policy development to be able to put within the electoral process, which we don't necessarily have right now, as I see.
That's right. And the kind of political education, you know, right. that could be made available to me, you know, all of this brain trust, all of this brain power of these young people. And one of the things I think we could have a whole nother show on that I've been aware of, being that I'm out here where Black Lives Matter started, is that many people don't appreciate is the extent to which the Black Lives Matter movement is itself a movement within the Black movement. You know, here in Oakland, Oscar Grant happened in 2009, January 1st, 2009. Black Lives Matter doesn't launch until 2013 after the Oscar Grant. After the Trayvon Martin verdict, the George Zimmerman verdict, right? 4 years later. So in between that, there have been all kinds of movement in activism here in Oakland. At no point from the time Barack Obama was elected until the time he was inaugurated did Oakland rest. There was constant movement and activism going on around the shooting and killing of Oscar Grant on Christmas Eve, 08-09. And in a real way, the Black Lives Matter movement exposes itself as a movement that centers sexuality and gender as its real interest, more so than police reform and social justice for Black men who are killed by white police officers or other cops, exactly. and also the white and let off by white jurors. Black Lives Matter is really a movement within a movement. It's almost kind of a parasitic movement coming 4 years after the Black movement out here in the West Coast anyway, and attached itself. I'm saying that Black Lives Matter comes out of the Oscar Grant movement here in Oakland. And to trying to understand Black Lives Matter as an epiphenomena by itself outside of the context of its root here in the West Coast, out here with the Black Panthers, and that history is a terrible mistake. It's all sort of grounded together. But I say that to say that the Black Panther Party came to an awareness when it got so sort of strident in its Marxism that it began to criticize the Black churches, even though the Black church had allowed the Panthers to use their facilities for the breakfast programs and was the main supporter of the Panthers. As they became caught up in this West Coast radical chic, they began to lambast the churches. And David Hilliard went in Berkeley famously and cursed out a room full of preachers and called them every kind of low dog he could. David Hilliard did. And Huey Newton understood the damage that had been done, and he began to come up with the idea of the breakfast programs and the sicker cell programs as a way of recovering the Panthers' relationship and restoring themselves to the Black community. Most people don't realize that. The Panthers have what Huey says, and you can look this up. Huey wrote about this in Revolutionary Suicide, I believe it was, or To Die for the People. He talks about the fact that Eldridge Cleaver had defected the Black community. He said Eldridge had defected the Black Panthers and the Black Panthers had defected the Black community when it began to criticize the Black community for its religious position and status. And I'm using that as an example to say that Black Lives Matter similarly, I think, is on the verge of defecting the Black community when you want to assert LGBT sexuality in the Black movement and demand that Black Protestants, Black people who are overwhelmingly Protestant, it's who they are, whether you like it or not. That's who they are. And like your relatives who are religious, some of our relatives are religious. That's who our people are. And so you can go beyond them and demand, you know, that they get rid of their religious false consciousness or their opiate, if you want, come at them that way. But when the Panthers did that, they lost touch with the people and they had to figure out how to get back in touch. And they couldn't do it until they came up with the good idea of the sicker cell and the breakfast programs. And I'm saying that to say Black Lives Matter has effectively, when you assert, you know, sexuality before as the principal organizing principle of a Black movement, you are challenging the principal institution still in Black American life, which is the Black church. And so Black Lives Matter, to me, is really a revolution within a revolution. It's a movement within a movement. It's an agitation within a Black agitation. And its principal focus is asserting the sexuality status of LGBTQ individuals and communities in ways that, and Black women, heterosexual, in ways that compensate for the ways that they were marginalized in the previous movements, going back to our conversation earlier about Bayard Rustin, but also about Black, you know, lesbian women, you know, they had always been marginalized in the modern civil rights movement with in the Nation of Islam. I'm looking at a new book right now by a colleague of mine over at Berkeley named Eula Yvette Taylor. The new book on the Nation of Islam is called The Promise of Patriarchy, Women and the Nation of Islam. It just came out a couple of weeks ago in the University of North Carolina Press, and it documents, you know, that relationship of Black women and the Nation of Islam and the role of patriarchy, you know, in that movement. And I'm suggesting to you that Black Lives Matter is an extension of a feminist critique of the civil rights movement's male leadership, from Martin King to Huey Newton, from you know, from I Have a Dream to what bell hooks called, it's a D, I won't say the word on your show, but it's a D thing nationalism is what bell hooks called it in her writing. And so, you know, that is part of what is at play. There's a tension between Black men and Black women that is in play in the Black Lives Matter movement, and defining those relationships that are in transition as well. And we're so close to it you know, we probably can't, you know, well define it right now, but I think we do need to recognize that we are in the midst of an emergent reality in the Black community that we're not going to be the same after this. We're not going to be the same like we weren't the same after Black Power. We're not going to be the same as a people after Black Lives Matter.
Professor Taylor, I want to thank you for spending some time with us, man. And it's time.
I enjoyed it wholeheartedly.
I enjoyed it too.
Listen,
thank you, brother.
I'm gonna be in touch with you too because I know that you constantly putting material out and writing, and I want you to email me some of the blogs so I can put them on the site so other people can
I'll be glad to.
Great. Great, and I'll be.
And the other brother wanted my information from the other show.
Oh, I'll pass it along to him because I'm in touch with him. So I'll pass it along to him.
Thank you, brother, so much. I appreciate it.
We'll be in touch.
And your audience members can get my book, Black Nationalism in the United States.
Oh, yeah. Wait a minute. Give out all the context, the contacts and things like that. Go ahead.
You can just read this. James Lance Taylor, Black Nationalism in the United States, in paperback. Don't buy the hard copy. Buy the paperback. It's way cheaper. And, you know, from what I've been told by several scholars, is one of the best books on Black nationalism that they've read. And I've tried to ground it deeply in our history, in our culture, and in our politics. And so, you know, to me, it's like with all this talk about Black Lives Matter and what we're experiencing, I wrote a book called Black Nationalism in the United States, From Malcolm X to Barack. So I'm trying to define what it is we've been experiencing from a Black perspective. And people don't reward you for writing books on Black nationalism. You don't get brought to prominent institutions, you know, Harvard, Yale. They're not bringing a brother writing a book on Black nationalism to University of Pennsylvania because they're scared of you. I knew what I was doing when I wrote that book, and I know what I'm doing in writing the next one on People's Temple, Jim Jones, and California Black politics because, you know, David Walker one time said in the 1820s, Black people need witnesses. You know, and I want to be a witness for whatever time I have left on this earth. I want to be a witness for what I understand and what I've seen and what I know has happened to our people here in this country.
Professor Taylor, I'll be in touch.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right. Peace. We'll be right back to start kind of winding things down. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Overworked?
suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
In 1492, you came up on these shores. 700 years educated by the Moors. 17th century, genocide in the gun. Middle Passage blessed to market the Africans in the so-called land of God. My kind were treated hard. From back then until now, I see and you agree, we have been a misrepresented people. From back then until now, just see my family tree, we have been a misrepresented people. We have been a misrepresented people.
Yes, we have been a mistake.
Awakening. I want to thank our guests for this evening, author, professor of political science, and director of African American Studies at the University of San Francisco, Professor James Lance Taylor, was here to share with us. Interesting conversation, Brother Richard. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's a continuously developing one that we have to really continue to put the nuts and bolts to in order to give that communication to people of really what we need to do.
You know, he before Professor Taylor left, and he was talking about the direction of Black Lives Matter and how it's turning more into a sexual or lifestyle revolution, so to speak. But, you know, it goes along with the conversation we've been having tonight. I think that was the objective of the money that was poured into that organization. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was the objective of Soros and others that wanted these things to take place. So right. Sometimes where the money goes, the direction of the movement follows. But that doesn't take into account some of the individuals involved. Similar to what we were talking about with King and the money that was poured into some certain guy's hands while he was alive. It was obvious that his mindset started to change. And Malcolm's, you know, both of the central mm-hmm. figures during that period, Malcolm's mindset started to change towards him because he called him a Tom. He put him with some of the other men that he knew had took money. But I think that he started realizing something different about King. And, you know, when he approached him and things that happened before he lost his life. And then after Malcolm lost his life, King's opinion started to change about some of the men he had been affiliated with and their ultimate objectives. Because and then he lost his life because of his direction was changing and his philosophy had definitely changed. And just like Jay mentioned, all of the men that were surrounding him during that period, if they're still alive, they got plenty of money. Some of them are millionaires. Even some of the men that were involved in that movement during that time had money. And it's kind of funny that after he was assassinated, I think that Belafonte and Ossie Davis and them had to give money to help bury him and take care of his family. So it's obvious that if it was money going around, he must not have got much of it. So, you know, it's lessons that we can learn through history, Richard. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just, and, you know, as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, I've always been pushing this ever since I heard this sociologist, Julius Wilson. He was saying that after the Civil Rights Bill passed, what you do notice is that the Black middle class, the economic disparity that occurred between those in the middle separating from those at the bottom increased a large percentage because of the still. So it isn't just the Black, quote unquote, Black leadership of the civil rights movement, but a certain class of people also. And it was those who were able to move away from the Black community. So when you talk about integration, where people use that symbol integration, you also see another movement, a migration of Blacks who increased their income. And then out of that increase through these desegregation policies, were able to move in areas that left the people who weren't able to move. And you're talking about those who were of the poor, as working poor and poor Blacks. And that separation creates a whole nother dynamics that we have to take in mind when we're talking about the politics of the Black community.
And, you know, Richard, on the surface, I don't think it's necessarily wrong for people that have more means to want more for their family, so to speak. Mm-hmm. If you live in a two-bedroom house and you want to live in a rural area or you want a farm or things of that nature. But I think what causes the problem is just like your friend in that book, the title of that book, Addicted to White. See, when that's in the back of your mind, that somehow you want to be close to white folk. You want to be accepted by white folk. See, that's what causes the problem. It's all a mental thing. It's in the mind. These problems start, and the revolution is first going to have to start in the mind. We got to change our mindset and how we're looking at ourselves. Understanding that clearly, just like Stevie mentioned in that song, we've been a misrepresented people. And among ourselves, we've been misrepresented. Because some of our people don't even know the story of what has really went on. And especially dealing with this man. I mean, we have to develop, because he has definitely developed a war strategy in dealing with black folks. That's clear. And if it's not clear to some black people, then they got to do a little more studying. They dropped their books, must have lost their lesson or something. They got to study a little bit more. Because in all of his policies, it's a war strategy. Look, I mean, this latest thing where he's not interested in giving putting any jobs out there for black folks, a living wage jobs. Let me clear that up. Living wage jobs. It might be a few jobs out there now where you need two or three of them to make ends meet. But I'm talking about living wage jobs. It's definitely no money out there for business startups or anything like that if you're black. But it's plenty of room in corrections facilities, both state, federal, and county, for black folks if they want it. Mm. Plenty of room. You'll never see a no vacancy sign up there. If it ain't room, they'll make room. So, you know, we got a choice to make moving forward. I mean, we got to be serious about what we're doing. As far as a cultural renaissance, as far as educating our children, as far as a new political stance, at least while we're here, all of those things as tools that we can use wherever we go. Mm-hmm. If our people migrate to another area, if there's a mass migration to another area, we still got to know how to do things. We still got to know how to govern ourselves. We still got to know how to educate one another. It's going to be a need for doctors, all types of things.
Right.
Tradesmen. You've got to have some type of skill. And you can't go anywhere else and be a burden on anybody else's society.
That's a fact.
Yeah, you know, I did get word from over there at the Buy Black Marketplace and the pre-Kwanzaa celebration at the Church of the Advocate. That Brother Oba and them was talking about last week, a successful event. I didn't make it because I was worn out. My brother went over there, and he said that when he went, I think he got there at 7 o'clock because, you know, after we got out of there, he still, you know, wanted to run over there. So he went. He said it was still loaded.
Right.
And you know, when he was here, he said all the vendors, there was no more space for any vendors. So it was very well attended. And, I'm happy about that because that funds celebration at Malcolm X Park, the parade, and all those other things. Those events like that help fund that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's on a small scale as far as black people funding things for black people, and especially for the children. So, you know, all of that is great, man. We're going to be working with him, you know, at different things coming up in the future. So, you know, he's a part of the Time for Awakening family as far as I'm concerned.
Great.
Again, new program starting up. It's slated to start up the first week in January. Let's Buy Black 365.com, hosted by Sister Nataki and, oh, my goodness. The other brother's name escapes me. It's a brother that's hosting with her. He's part of the Black Lawyers for Justice down there with down there in Washington D.C. But his name escapes me. I don't want to. I'll have it straightened up for Friday. In fact, she might come on to kind of billboard the program that's coming up. At least two programs is slated to start in January and one for the first week in February. So And we're moving forward. There's a couple other things that we're not going to mention right now until we nail down all the particulars. But there's some things that might be happening in regards to the Time for Awakening radio program and the expansion of it. But like I said, we won't mention these things until after we kind of nail down all the particulars to it. You heard Brother Oshie on here just before Dr. Taylor left. Tomorrow he'll be on 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. with African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. On Wednesday, Revive is back. Sister POC from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. On Thursdays, Us Lifting Us, Black Economic Program, is on from 9 to 11 p.m. on Thursday evening. On Fridays, we're back with Time for Awakening at 8 p.m. Friday evenings. And then on Saturdays, SST, Saturday Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore at 10 a.m. to 12 noon. And hopefully, if he works out the technical issues, we'll have Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers on Saturdays from 4 to 6. Again, I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of.